for irrigated agriculture. Ms. Hewitt, roll call, please.
Daniel Press.
Present.
Russell Jeffries.
Present.
Jeffrey Young.
Here.
Bruce Daniels.
Present.
We don't have a quorum, but this is noticed as a workshop, and the board won't be taking any action, so it's okay that there's no quorum.
Thank you. And then I'll finish the roll with, I can't read the name.
We got Les.
Les Balker.
Don Villeneuve.
Gary Shellcross.
Gary Shellcross.
And Don Villeneuve.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Introduction, Mr. Briggs.
Thank you. To my left, we just heard from Lori Oaken, our counsel from the State Water Resources Control Board. And we also heard from Carol Hewitt. And sitting next to Carol Hewitt is Brad Hageman of our staff. We have testimony cards in the hands of Amanda back there to look like this.
By the way, we do have some chairs down front here, right in front of this table. There's some chairs, so please come.
There are also two chairs or seats available right there.
Right.
And I see a seat over or two over here, you folks. And Brad, could we bring some chairs in from the coffee room over there? Thanks. So anyway, as I was saying, the testimony cards look like this. If you could please fill those out, that's what we use to call upon you. And even if you're not interested in speaking today, but if you would like to get on our mailing list for this item, you go ahead and fill it out and then just check the box that says you do not wish to testify. And let's see, Gary Carlton is our representative, our liaison from the State Water Resources Control Board, and he called me yesterday, was planning on attending, but unfortunately is ill, and the doctor grounded him. So that's it for our one other thing. We have supplemental sheets for this item, and this is information that was just available in the last couple weeks since we mailed the agenda item itself. We have one supplemental sheet, which we mailed last Friday, so some of you may have received that already if you're on our interested parties list. We have another one that was just handed out today, and we do have extra copies, I hope, of this available for those of you who would like to see it. And are those in the back of the room there? And again, I think Amanda can help with copies of those. Are there any, so you don't have to get up, are there any folks who would like copies of those? Raise your hand. Everybody squared away, huh? Oh, here's one.
One, two down front.
Okay. Thank you. And that's it for introductions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. As was mentioned, this is a workshop on this issue today, so we will be taking no action on this. We may give some direction to staff to go look at something or come back with some data or something, but we'll not make any decision. That will be made by the full board at a future meeting. We're not completely sure which meeting that'll happen at. We had been planning on the March meeting, but I understand now that may be looking a little doubtful. So stay tuned. I think we have a staff report on this item.
Yes, both Allison Jones and Karen Worcester have been working on this issue for the last year or so. And today, Allison Jones is going to be making the staff presentation.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Daniels, members of the board, members of the public. I want to thank everyone for showing up again today. Some of you have become familiar faces through this process, and I know for several of you I see a lot of new faces, so I think this is good that we're having this extra workshop. We've had two workshops prior to this, one in Santa Barbara and one up at Salinas. The main purpose of today's workshop is to provide time for additional public comment and board questions and comments as well. So with that in mind, I'm going to be keeping my comments and my overview quite brief. I'll summarize what's being proposed and why, and then talk a little bit about some of the information provided in the supplemental sheets that was in response to questions that came up at the Salinas workshop. Oh, just mentioning that one of the of revised supplemental sheets was a revised groundwater table that included more information on groundwater monitoring efforts that are going on in the region. We're currently working to compile more information on surface water monitoring as well, and we'll be looking at that as part of the monitoring requirements and incorporating what is existing and making sure that we've taken that into account. The map up on the screen highlighted in green shows the Central Coast region, and that's the area that where these proposed conditional waivers would be applicable. And it includes part of San Mateo County, Santa Cruz County, part of Santa Clara County, San Benito County, Monterey County, San Luis Obispo County, Santa Barbara County, and a little bit of Ventura County, and that's the area of jurisdiction of the Central Coast Regional Board. First, I want to briefly summarize what's being proposed and what farmers are being asked to do. Actually, it's not too complicated. We're saying that we'd like all growers in the region to actively protect water quality by attending 15 hours of farm water quality training over a three-year period, developing farm water quality plans, implementing management practices to protect water quality, and participating in some level of monitoring of water quality. Okay. We recognize also that many people have already begun to do some of those things, and part of the intent of this program is to acknowledge that people have invested considerable resources and time and have already begun doing a lot of the things that we're asking everyone to do. And we try to acknowledge that in the program. Why is action being proposed at this time? First, we have considerable data showing water quality impacts in our agricultural areas throughout the region. This is a largely agricultural region, and we have documented water quality impacts in a lot of our agricultural areas. The other reason is that we have changes in state law pertaining to waivers, and agriculture had been operating under waivers since 1983, although probably no one knew that, and I'll explain a little bit about how things are changing as we go through this. Okay. The map up there is just a larger close-up of the region, and the areas in green are areas of concentrated agricultural activity in the region. Up at the top, I don't know if you can read it, but we have the Pajaro River and then the Salinas River running through the center of the region. Both of those drain, of course, to Monterey Bay. Down lower, we have San Luis Obispo Creek identified, Morro Bay, Santa Maria River, San Ynez River, and then down at the bottom, the coastal Santa Barbara areas. And again, those areas highlighted in green are where we have concentrated agricultural activities throughout the region. Okay. This is the same map, and it shows waters that have been identified as impaired from pollutants associated with agriculture, primarily nutrients and pesticides. It includes the Pajaro River, Salinas River, and tributaries and portions of those water bodies. Also, Choro Creek, San Luis Obispo Creek, Santa Maria, Santa Ynez, and some of the little areas around coastal Santa Barbara are not yet listed, but we anticipate that they will be. We have about 40 water bodies that are listed and identified as impaired from agricultural pollutants. Okay. So again is the regional map, and this is groundwater data compiled from a number of sources for a 1995 study that looked at nitrate concentrations in groundwater throughout the region. And the areas in red are where the average nitrate concentrations were greater than the drinking water standard. We're not identifying agriculture as the only source, but again, there's high correlation between areas of agricultural activities and where these we see these high levels.
Just a second, Allison. Mm-hmm. Can we move this table forward, and then we can put another row of chairs behind it? That way people can actually get up here and sit down. So there are some chairs up front. So if any of you in the back want to move forward and take one of these additional chairs. Still two more. Three more. Okay, Allison, thank you.
Okay,
sorry for that interruption.
That's okay. The other reason for the proposed changes is that legal requirements have regarding waivers have changed in recent years. Regional boards are a state agency that's responsible for implementing water quality laws and regulations in the state of California. One of the principal ways we do that is through regulating discharges of waste to waters of the state with permits that are called waste discharge requirements. Okay. So I'm just going to take a minute to define terms, and for those of you that have heard this a few times, you might want to think of something more pleasant for a minute or two. But I'm going to talk a little bit about what is a water of the state. And what we mean are surface waters such as streams and rivers, bays and estuaries and lakes, and also groundwater. So those are all considered water of the state. Okay. When we talk about waste, what we mean are substances associated with human activities. In the case of agriculture, we can include production activities and activities associated with processing. So both of those can result in the production of waste. Agricultural wastes can include fertilizers, pesticides, and sediments. Now, we recognize that those also serve a function, and they only become waste when they stop doing what they're really supposed to be doing and start and enter the waters of the state. So that's when they become a waste. So what we mean by a discharge is just basically a release of one of these wastes to a water of the state. And it can be directly to surface water. It can be through stormwater runoff that picks up pollutants and carries them into a water of the state. Or it could be through percolation to groundwater. Now, we're talking about waivers, so let me take a second to explain what we mean by a waiver. Regional boards, as I said, they're one of their primary ways of regulating and protecting water quality is through regulating discharges of waste. They also are allowed to, under certain circumstances, waive waste discharge requirements if it is in the public interest to do so. In 1983, the Regional Board approved waivers for a number of categories of waste discharges, and they included in those categories waivers for irrigation return flows, or tailwater, and stormwater runoff. In 1999, the state law pertaining to waivers was amended, and what that did was cause all the existing waivers to expire as of January 1st, 2003. So the old waivers that we did have expired, and this process is to develop a replacement for those waivers. The new requirements are that the waivers cannot exceed 5 years in length. They have conditions that must be enforced. What we're proposing as far as waiver conditions, a number of things. The items listed in bold are mandatory requirements. And down at the bottom, you can see that what's not in bold is where we have more discretion or we have more choice of how we put this program together. So all the waivers must comply with the basin plan, and that would include any adopted TMDLs, total maximum daily loads. They may not cause or contribute to exceedance of water quality standards, not cause condition of pollution or nuisance, and the other new additional requirement is that there be a monitoring associated with the waivers. But where we have discretion is deciding how that monitoring program is designed. Excuse me, I think that's my son. I had to laugh a little. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about how the program's been developed. From the outset, we felt that it was necessary to bring in interested parties to try to develop a program that would make sense for our region, because I think it is different from other parts of the state in the type of agriculture that we have, and the fact that we did have considerable effort being put forward to protect water quality by significant numbers of agriculturalists in the region. I felt it was important to get both the environmental and agricultural interests together to help develop the program. And with that in mind, we set up an agricultural advisory panel to help us develop some of the recommendations. The idea would be that the panel would provide recommendations to staff in developing the program. So we have a panel that has been meeting for several months over the past year. It's provided a forum for communication between agricultural and environmental interests in the regional board and given us input in developing the program. And the panel has developed some level of agreement on preliminary recommendations. And those include, the panel participants include agricultural representatives such as a number of the farm bureaus throughout the region and grower-shipper representative and the Agricultural Land-Based Training Association, which works with Latino growers in the region. We also had environmental representatives such as Ocean Conservancy, Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo, Channel Keeper and Environmental Defense Center in the Monterey Bay Sanctuary, as well as technical advisors from University of California. And the preliminary panel recommendations are that the waivers have a tiered structure that recognizes that a number of growers throughout the region have already been making efforts to protect water quality, that there be education requirements, and that every farm have a plan for water quality protection, management practice implementation reporting was part of the recommendations, and a three-year time limit for a plan completion and meeting the education requirements. We recognize that management practice implementation will be an ongoing process, that will not all be completed within the first 3 years, but the panel felt it was important that plans be developed and that education be completed as soon as possible. Some of the issues of concern that have been raised at other workshops include details of the monitoring program, some of the associated fees and costs, the availability of education opportunities, and outreach. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about some of the things that staff's been doing to address some of those concerns. The monitoring program is still being developed, so it's not finalized yet by any means. There's still a lot of ongoing discussion about how the monitoring should look. One of the requirements of the monitoring program, however, is that it support the development and implementation of the waiver and that it verify the adequacy and effectiveness of the waiver conditions. So that's a requirement of the monitoring program. How that is structured is still up to the regional board staff and regional board to develop and approve. Some of the things we're still looking at are the costs and the benefits of various approaches and working with the advisory panel to develop some recommendations of what the monitoring should look like. Again, that's still under development. But one of the options that's being considered is a cooperative region-wide monitoring approach where you basically be monitoring a network of sites at the bottoms of watersheds and looking at water quality in those certain sites. And what that would allow us to do is distribute and lower the costs. So that's one of the things that we're looking at still. And we did a projection of possible costs associated with that type of a monitoring program for small, say a 10-acre operation, a 100-acre operation, and a 1,000-acre operation. And the range of costs up here would be based on basically threat to water quality. So depending on the type of discharge and how much impact it would be having on water quality, you would be somewhere in that range, that cost range. Again, this is very preliminary, but just give an idea of what costs might look like. And this would include both the toxicity testing as well as looking at nutrients over like 12 times a year. So this would be just some general idea of what the cost might look like. Okay. Fee and education costs. Possible fees. The regional board does not set a fee schedule. That is set at the state level. But we thought it would be worthwhile to try to come up with reasonable fee costs to support the program with the idea that we could make a recommendation at the very least. So what we're looking at here are possible fees ranging from $100 to $300, either annually if you were in the tier two of the waiver program or once in 5 years if you were in the top tier of the program. Estimated education costs somewhere between $40 and $50, and that would be more or less a one-time cost. If you once you've completed the 15 hours of education requirement, there would not be additional costs for education. So that's just kind of a range of total costs for the fees in education. But again, this is not something that the regional board actually can set. And then the questions came up about cost of management practices. We're still sort of working to compile some information on cost of management practices. There's a wide range of practices that can be implemented, and costs can vary. Sometimes there's opportunities for cost savings, but we recognize that you know, some things are very expensive, especially if you're going from a sprinkler or some other type of system to a drip system. There's considerable investment involved. But we also recognize that there's opportunity to phase in practices, that there's not a requirement to implement a certain type of practice right off the bat. So there is flexibility there. And we are working with UC Cooperative Extension and the Natural Resources Conservation Service to get more detailed cost estimates. Another concern that's been raised is the availability of education opportunities. One of the prime ways of meeting this requirement would be the farm water quality short courses, which provide 15 hours of training, and you leave the course with a completed plan, or you can. Right now, the courses are funded through June of this year, so we are pursuing all avenues to try to find additional funding for those courses, and some of those possibilities are identified in Attachment 4, and we'll continue to work to try to get those funded. We're also looking at other courses and had some discussion about other courses that could meet the requirement, and if you have a requirement over 5 hours a year for 3 years, there are probably other ways to meet the education requirement than the short course, so we'll look at that as well. And again, we will also assess the availability after a couple of years to see that that's not a major hindrance in people complying with the conditions. Okay. Concerns have been expressed that there hasn't been adequate outreach, especially to non-English speaking growers. Something that is happening right now, we're pursuing the possibility of doing some Spanish language translations. The Farm Water Quality Short Course has been translated into Spanish, so we will continue to look into those options. Ongoing outreach, we're doing presentations wherever requested and as much as possible to make sure that people are aware of this effort and have opportunity to provide input. And it will be a priority once the regional board adopts something. It's going to be a priority for staff to make sure that they continue outreach prior to the enrollment deadline. Okay. As far as the next steps, we need to complete the resolution, the waiver program itself, and the monitoring reporting program, and complete CEQA and hold a 30-day public comment period, and then have the board hearing a decision. And this is a revised tentative timetable, would be to complete the program and CEQA through February and March, and then have the 30-day comment period and bring the item to the board for hearing in May, at the May meeting. So that's sort of the proposed timetable right now. Okay. And with that, I am going to stop and allow for public comment and board discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The only comment, and I think you've probably outlined most of the comments and discussion the board had in Salinas and also Santa Barbara. One area you didn't touch on, and it was raised probably at both locations, is the proprietary information that is submitted by the different ranches. Have you been in contact with our legal counsel? Is there some way that we can protect those individuals, ranches that have information that are specific to their particular way that they handle this?
Well,
do you want me to address that? Actually, okay. The State Board issued an order a week or so ago on the Central Valley Region's ag waiver, and the same issue was raised there. A lot of the growers were concerned that the requirements of the waiver would either be an invasion of privacy or would require them to reveal trade secrets. And what the state board held was that there's a provision in the Port of Cologne section that deals with monitoring that addresses trade secrets and establishes a procedure. And it's up to the grower who is asserting that we're requiring trade secret information. The grower has to justify and demonstrate why the information actually qualifies as a trade secret. And once that demonstration is made, then that information isn't available to the public. It's not a public record, but we can use it in our program, and we can also use it for purposes of doing enforcement.
Are there guidelines for the individual to do that, and who makes the determination that it meets the criteria?
I'm not aware of any guidelines. There's general case law on what's a trade secret. As far as who makes the determination, at the initial level, it would be made, I believe, by staff, because it's subject to the monitoring requirements, which generally are part of staff's domain. I'm sure it could be appealed to the regional board.
Okay.
If there's, well, that's it.
Can I just add a little bit to that? Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point out that on the rare occasions when it has come up before, and the only times I can remember coming up are on cleanup cases, but we have consulted with our counsel. We've gone over the information with the counsel to get a reading on it.
But there is a way, there is a process.
Right.
Okay. I think that's important.
I think the other concern that's been raised is that farm plans would be required to be submitted, and that's not envisioned. So the information that we would request would be in some form of a checklist of practices that are being implemented on an acreage basis. A map, the map that's being requested or is envisioned is the same map that's submitted as part of the pesticide use reporting.
Well, I'm sure you heard as well as I did loud and clear that there was tremendous concern for that particular type mm-hmm. of information, and as long as there's an avenue and a way and there's a procedure that can handle it, then fine. That satisfies my concern at this particular time.
Okay. Some more questions?
Yeah. Allison, the monitoring fees that you put up, the proposed fees, is that something that then our board has power to adopt?
Not the way it's envisioned. Basically, they are not fees. They're if you did a cooperative monitoring the way that has been set up in other places, is that dischargers actually, there would be an entity that would collect fees and then just let us know that they've been paid, and then somebody could opt to do that in lieu of doing their individual monitoring.
Are we talking about the waiver fee, or are we talking about monitoring?
You're talking
fees.
About monitoring costs, okay. Yeah. So they're not really fees.
Okay.
Yes.
So the fees will be set by the state board. Any idea when that is going to take place?
No idea.
They haven't set any sort of timeline for considering that. What they did say in the Region 5 order was if there's an ability to hire staff to work on the agricultural programs, then they'll consider a fee schedule. But at this point, because of the hiring freeze, they couldn't use those fees to administer the program anyway.
And I take it then that they're receiving input from all the regions and that this fee schedule is going to be the same throughout the state.
I would imagine, although nobody's asked our input to this point.
Okay.
But we thought it was worth trying.
Something that has come up in my mind as I continue to review all the material that we've had is some way to try to be equitable in the distribution of these, either the fees or what we project to be the cost to do monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, the fees look like they're going to be a flat fee per farm. And, $100 to $300 is, probably not a big deal. However, it certainly benefits the larger farm, and that there's more acreage to spread that out over in terms of recovery. Well, it penalizes the little guy.
Well, and we heard that comment, and with the monitoring, what we did was look at sort of a base and then add a per acre charge to try to sort of alleviate that. With the fees, the thinking was the administrative costs would be the same, and we'll just try to keep them low but distribute them. I mean, there's different ways to approach it.
Right. Well, I'm certainly in favor of an approach that doesn't penalize someone because they have a smaller farm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't want there to be an unintended consequence of what we do at all in terms of, penalizing a small grower. I don't think that's helpful. Then looking at those projected monitoring costs, again, there is a larger per acre cost on the smaller guy.
If you
want to put that back up, we could look at that. And I just made some notes on my paper.
Yeah, it was down to $1 an acre for 1,000.
Right.
Yeah, it is still a little bit. It's less than it was before,
right.
But it still is. One of the problems in trying to do a cooperative approach is you didn't need to get enough money to keep the program going, and in our region, 2/3 of our operations are under 50 acres approximately. So we do have a predominance of small growers.
Okay. Well, if we could just kind of keep that in mind as we start to fine tune this, I'm more in favor of an approach that tries to level the playing field as much as possible. And you can try to work something to death, and you're not getting any return out of all the effort we would put into it, but I think we need to use an approach like that. The other thing, I don't know how you have factored this in yet, but how about the walnut orchard that waters three times per year, irrigates three times per year, or the operation that's organic?
Right. Well, we're still looking at sort of a low threat option where you could actually waive all or most costs. And the other thing is you might have a more of a scale between charge more for the ones that are more higher threat, so make that upper end of the range higher, and with the idea that there's more incentive then to reduce discharge. In other words, if you're discharging tailwater, you're more of a threat to water quality than if you have a drip system and very little stormwater runoff.
Well, I'm in favor of something like that.
Yeah. So we're still working on
that. Okay. And then,
in fact, if you have an organic farm, one would think that there would be no toxicity effects, probably no nitrate effects.
No, you could have nitrate effects. There's no, just because it's organic doesn't mean that you can't put on a lot of nitrates. It doesn't. That's been also documented. So, anyway.
Okay, that's good to point out.
And one other category would be, we have data that shows contamination, nitrate and pesticides. Have we identified some areas where there are no impacts to water quality, where we have farming, and maybe those operations could also enroll under the lowest threat category?
We've had considerable discussion about how to do that in a fair manner. You could have areas where there are documented water quality problems and yet you have an operation that's doing everything right. Do you charge, how do you equitably charge them? Versus you could have a where we have monitoring data and we have less data in some areas than others, it doesn't look like there's a problem, but we don't know. So do we, there should be incentive to, improve, and there should be incentive to change practices. So all of those things need to be sort of put into it, but we're still trying.
There should be a mechanism that we work with through time that kind of weeds these differences out.
Right.
So,
Mr. Chair, I just have one other question. I don't want to take any more time because I want to hear from the folks that are here today, and that's what they're here for. Can you give us your definition of cooperative monitoring?
Well, cooperative monitoring.
Does that mean 10 acres combined with 100 acres or 10 100 acres combined 1,000 acres? What is the staff's interpretation of that?
A cooperative monitoring program would basically be where you have sites at the bottom of watersheds where there's agricultural activity, and you monitor those on a regular basis. The cooperative part comes in where everybody's basically contributing to the overall monitoring program.
So, and the cost?
And the cost.
Within that watershed.
Well, but there would be network sites monitoring many watersheds, so you would try to have a network that would cover the region. Obviously, we're not going to monitor every single watershed. And then what we would do then is augment that monitoring with monitoring through other sources through our CCAMP program.
All right. Like I said, I'd like to hear from the public. That's okay. What this is about.
Mr. Press, you have some questions?
It's a quick comment. There's a real attractiveness to the cooperative approach. It could reduce costs considerably, though it could also increase the complexity for any particular grower. So what the cooperative approach leaves unclear for now, I think, is how people would get together, find each other, find a third party to do the monitoring. In other words, there's some costs in networking to do that, and that probably needs to be figured out a little bit more, because that could get quite complicated. You spend a lot of time trying to do that.
Yeah, one of the things we're considering is having some resources through some of the monies that we have, possibly through settlement funds, to help set up the structure for that.
That would be great.
Well, the other concern with that would be liability. If there was contamination, who's responsible?
The cooperative program is really designed to detect change over time and to see whether the waiver program is working. We'd have to use the data that you get from the monitoring in conjunction with practices that are being reported, records that are kept on site. So all of that would come into play in terms of trying to figure out where a problem is coming from.
Another question?
Allison, just a couple more points. Groundwater. We're not proposing any groundwater monitoring. Is that
correct?
Accurate?
Yes.
We're just going to use existing groundwater sampling efforts by the various counties and water supply agencies.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
I had another question. I'll just wait on.
Well, I have a question about groundwater monitoring. I can do that. I was under the understanding that one of the best practices for the nitrate you put on the soil is that you don't just put it on. You decide how much is already going on. So one of the things you do is look at the nitrate that is, for example, in your irrigation water, so you don't put on excess. And if that's the case, and of course most of our farms, I would imagine, are irrigated from groundwater, so if they're doing good practices, they're already finding out the levels of nitrate in their irrigation water.
Right, and I think many are, and that's one of the things we'd like to encourage. And that's part of the reason in including groundwater in this, the fact that we have documented problems, but also the fact that we want people to think about that when they're implementing their practices.
Right, and in fact, I've heard that if farms do that, that can actually save real dollars, because it means that it's less fertilizer they may have to put on their land if they already are getting, five parts per whatever of nitrate already in the water, then they can reduce their fertilizer correspondingly. So it would seem like a good practice from both the water protection as well as for just good operation. Relative to the panel, I think, all of us here on the board probably support the idea of getting groups together and talk out the problems and come to compromises, and certainly to the extent the board can support that, I think that's good. But, of course, there are certain things that you could go on talking about forever and never come to agreement. And do we have a timeline here of cutting this off and saying, okay, well, we're just going to have the board make a decision?
Yeah, I think that we'd like to continue to work with the panel to find agreement on as much of the monitoring and as much of the overall program as possible, so that there are some recommendations that can be broadly supported. But, yes, we recognize that we're going to have to bring this to a close at some point.
Okay.
And
particularly since we're a year plus over the,
right.
the deadline.
And I hesitate to say May is the drop dead date, but I'd really like it to be. So.
Well, how are you doing with seeing the light at the end of the tunnel with the panel? I mean, you've had a couple of warm meetings mm-hmm. after our last workshop.
I think we're moving. We're making progress. Monitoring is a difficult issue. So, but I think we have made progress, and we have another meeting scheduled, and we tend to keep going with it.
I know it would be helpful to me, at least when this comes to the board for action, if we can have as many members of that ag panel present, so that if we have any questions, that we could bounce ideas off them.
Good to see that too.
Okay. Before we get started with the public testimony, there has been some mention of the Central Valley appeal. And of course, they had their own waiver they put in place, and everybody and their grandmother seems to have appealed that. And it looks like the board pretty much, the state board, that is, pretty much they made a few minor changes, but most of it was pretty much approved by the state board. I think one of the big issues there is just terminology. Some people see the word waiver and think, okay, farmers can go off and do whatever they want. This is a waiver that allows them to do anything they want. And we've never really intended just a waiver. This has always been a conditioned waiver. And whether it's a waiver or a WDR with conditions, there's still conditions. And so I think both sides here need to see that, you know, whether we call it a waiver or a WDR, you know, there's still what we're talking about is various conditions that we can put on that are reasonable and also can, you know, help us improve water quality, which I think is the bottom line for us.
Mr. Chair, what's a WDR?
Ah, yes, a waste discharge requirement, which is a regulation.
Well, there's a lot of folks.
You're absolutely right. All right, we're going to start the testimony now. People will have 3 minutes to give us some information. And in giving your comments, if everyone, and of course there are a lot of folks here, if people have already said what you wanted to say, you know, please do feel free to say, yeah, I agree with XYZ, and just we don't have to have that repeated if you can. First card is Miranda Leonard.
Good afternoon. My name is Miranda Leonard. I'm here today from the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo. I'm part of the Agricultural Advisory Panel, and today I'll also be speaking on behalf of my colleague, Caitlin Gaffney, from the Ocean Conservancy. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this issue. I've appreciated being part of the advisory panel to the Water Board and hope that board members will take the recommendations of the panel into account. Of course, water quality affects every member of our community. A successful waiver program is crucial to ensure that California's drinking water sources are protected. The new waivers are required to be issued in the public interest and must ensure a program that protects the beneficial uses of all groundwater and surface water. In order to achieve this goal, the waiver program must include benchmarks to demonstrate the success of the program. A connection needs to be made between the monitoring process and the goal of obtaining water quality standards needed to protect the waters of the state. The monitoring program needs accountability in order to show effectiveness. In order to achieve success in this program, feedback from the monitoring must be made immediately available to growers. Follow-up is critical by growers and regional water quality control board staff in order for growers to understand their effects on water quality and to respond accordingly. Staff must take steps to correct polluted waterways that have been identified by monitoring as a result of this program. The monitoring proposal currently proposed by staff is minimal. The adopted monitoring program must be technically rigorous and scientifically defensible. Scientific experts should be consulted to analyze monitoring, and the monitoring should be conducted on an ongoing basis. The program should pay for itself through fees and be sustainable, so that needed staff will be available to make this new program successful. The new waiver program should include best management practices, farm plans for pollution management, and short courses to develop such conditions. Funding for the educational component should be permanently in place. And undoubtedly, there will be problems experienced with any program that the board adopts, but a plan is needed now in order to come in compliance with state law. And if I may, I have comments from Caitlin Gaffney.
You have About 40 seconds.
I was told that I would have 6 minutes, 3 minutes for myself, and 3 minutes for Caitlin Gaffney.
Is this, who told you this?
Amanda.
Okay, we'll have to blame her then. I'll tell you what, we'll give you 3 more minutes.
So. Okay. This is from Caitlin Gaffney of the Ocean Conservancy, and she's also an advisory panel member. Her comments touch on 3 issues. First, I want to reiterate my support for the advisory panel process and urge the board to adopt the numerous program recommendations that the panel has agreed to thus far. Thanks to your staff and the time and effort of all the panel members, we have made significant progress over the past several months, and I believe we now have the framework for a workable program. Second, concerns have been raised about the staff's proposed monitoring program. The Ocean Conservancy believes that the proposal by staff describes the bare minimum of what is legally and scientifically defensible. We recognize that your staff has made every effort to pare down the monitoring program in an effort to reduce costs to growers. However, we must emphasize that adequate monitoring is a critical component of the program, is required by state law, and must be scientifically supportable. Finally, as you know, there is substantial evidence of widespread water quality impairment due to agricultural activities throughout Region 3. Any waiver adopted by this board must be in the public interest and must result in compliance with the basin plan and water quality objectives. The environmental community recognizes that compliance will not occur overnight, but the program must include reasonable benchmarks for measuring success and a plan for program adaptation if compliance is not achieved. Thank you.
Thank you. Kathleen Thomasberg. Next up would be Eric Cardenas. And then Kevin Merrill. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. You recognize my face. I've been working with Giulio Ferruzzi, NRCS, and Michael Kahn from UC Cooperative Extension, and this letter represents our opinion. As water resource professionals who work in the counties of the Central Coast, we have observed that the suggested waiver of discharge requirements for the Central Coast misses an important component of farm water quality. The missing component is irrigation efficiency. Background, tailwater runoff from irrigation systems may be responsible for transporting a large portion of sediments, nutrients, and pesticides that cause water quality problems in surface water. Additionally, excessive drainage from irrigation systems can transport nitrate and pesticides into groundwater supplies. As irrigation efficiency increases, the portion of the irrigation water contributing to runoff and deep drainage decreases. For example, if irrigation efficiency is low, less than 50%, then roughly half of the applied water will either run off agricultural fields and or drain below rooting zone of the crop. If irrigation efficiency is high, greater than 95%, less than 5% of the applied water would be lost to runoff or deep drainage. One of the most likely ways that growers can improve water quality will be to implement practices that improve irrigation efficiency. So, if growers are improving irrigation efficiency and the monitoring program does not show an improvement in water quality, then the agricultural community can still be credited for their efforts in complying with the conditional waiver. So, in summary, give irrigation efficient growers credit for contributing less ag return water. This will give growers more incentive to change irrigation management practices. Thank you for the opportunity to give this suggestion.
Thank you.
Question? Mr. Young? Follow-up questions. The extreme to that would be drip irrigation or irrigating maybe 3 times a year an orchard. And so has that been debated in the advisory panel?
Since Kathy's not a member of the panel, she can't really answer that. But I, yes, we've talked a lot about that. That's one of the prime practices that can impact water quality would be improving irrigation efficiency. Some of the discussion of how to encourage that through the different costs for monitoring, giving credit for, those kinds of things is part of what we've been sort of wrestling with and how do you set a cost schedule.
What does credit mean?
Credit could mean lower fees, lower reporting requirements, those kinds of things.
May I add a statement to that? In my conversation with both Julio and Michael, our concern was just because one has a drip irrigation system does not mean that it is operated properly. So, of course, I'm here to make that awareness with the board and, of course, staff. So,
well, I think it's interesting. I would encourage you to communicate with staff. And I mean, because I would like to read a letter from your group specifying
what you're suggesting,
you're suggesting, how it might be implemented. Water itself is not necessarily the problem. The problem is what's in it. And so, you know, it's a little more nebulous a concept to get our hands around.
Correct.
And, you know, growers are free to irrigate. That's nothing we're going to get involved with and tell them how much they should or shouldn't apply to their their fields.
One thought is that, for instance, if there are there is a water quality degradation and one looks around in that whole area around that monitoring site, so those people who are properly irrigating efficiently and operating that system, that's kind of okay. Well, this operation is off our list. Where else should we look for those others who may not be so efficient?
Okay. Well, in my next packet, I will be looking for a letter from you to staff.
Guaranteed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Next is Eric Cardenas, then Kevin Merrill, and Joy Fitzhugh. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the regional board and members of the public. My name is Eric Cardenas. I work with the Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara, direct our Central Coast Environmental Health Project, which focuses specifically on educating about pesticides and the effects of pesticide exposure, not just to the environment, but to human health. I do participate on the advisory panel and have done so for the last year. As I mentioned at the hearing in Salinas, it's been a very learning process, I think, for everybody there. And we have come up with some recommendations, which you have now heard a couple of different times. Those are the farm plans. I think everybody agrees that that's necessary to determine what is happening on site on different farms. The monitoring component, which we haven't figured out exactly how to do that, but everybody agrees that that's a critical component of the plan, as well as that is something that is required under the law with these types of waivers. And then finally, the educational component, which I think benefits everybody. But the sticking point, which has been the issue and continues to be and will be for the next couple of meetings, is how the monitoring is going to happen. And the issues here are mainly the methodology, where and how we're going to do this monitoring, and what the cost is going to be, who's going to pay for it. Is it going to be disproportionately cast upon the smaller growers, the organic farmers? So these are all things that we need to work out. The point I wanted to make, and the point that you've already seen through your staff presentations, is that monitoring data has already been collected for many, many years, and that data has been held onto or has been reviewed by staff, and I'm assuming regional board as well. And you do have areas that are impacted throughout the Central Coast region by high levels of nitrates, pesticides, sediment, what have you. We've already identified those problem areas, and they remain problem areas. I'm sure if we were to go out and do monitoring today in some of those areas that have already been identified, we'd still see some of those high levels if we were to go out there right now and do some of this monitoring. So maybe one of the options would be, as I mentioned at the first hearing in Santa Barbara, to prioritize the areas that have been previously identified and start there. Now, I'm not sure. This is all, you know, this is all up for discussion. But we need to really look at the areas that have been impacted and determine, do these problems continue? Have these problems continued? I think the fear is that if we implement a monitoring program here and now and start using the data or start looking at the data, what is actually going to mean a change from the actual results of the monitoring to a change in practice on the farm sites? We have the encouragement of best management practices in the plan before you, but we really, the Environmental Defense Center is really concerned about what those results mean and how those translate into action. If you get certain thresholds or you reach certain levels, there should be some action taken by board or staff to make sure that those problems are addressed in the future. And I think that is going to be the most critical part of this, because we can do monitoring till the end of time, and that could mean nothing in the long run.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Merrill, then Joy Fitzhugh, then Don Mathis. We have some more chairs over here, by the way, people.
There's one more.
There's one over here. Yeah. There's several got brought in over here, I saw.
One there.
Two over here,
I think. Two over there. So if you folks in the back don't want to stand the whole time.
Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and fellow board members. Thank you for letting me speak before you today. I come before you with two hats. One, I'm the president of Central Coast Wine Growers Association, and also president of the newly formed Watershed Coalition in Southern San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, and a member of the Ag panel that's meeting. We just met in Salinas last week, and I think we made some real progress at that last meeting. And I think the biggest thing we're talking about here as far as agriculture is concerned is the monitoring component of this, of the waiver program. And one of the things, as you can hear from the speakers before me, is the challenges we have before us. And Eric brings up a good point. We do know some areas that are impacted heavier than others. And to begin with, I think we would like to see us concentrate the monitoring program initially in those areas. And maybe we could use some existing funds to help us do that. I don't think that anybody has a real grasp of how we're going to monitor this and how much it's going to cost and how are we going to pay to rectify what's wrong. If we could focus on an area maybe in Monterey County and one in Santa Barbara County, again, using existing funding to help for the monitoring, we can make some real progress. And it would really help us in agriculture, who are proactive on this front, be able to sell it to the folks that are in agriculture and are kind of weighted with bated breath of what's going to come down the pike with them. They hear these numbers of how much it's going to cost for monitoring. We don't really know what that's based on. What program is that? I know that Karen's worked on it with C-Camp, and they've done their best to figure out what the program is going to cost, but we really don't know what the cost is. The benefit of having these initial monitoring projects, if you will, would help us understand better what it is we're trying to do and get it done and fix it. And we could go to the farming community at that time and say, these are the steps we've taken to monitor these problems. These are the steps we've taken to rectify them. This is what the real cost is going to be. It also buys us some time, I think, to develop some more funding opportunities that are out there, grants and so on, to help pay for it, and not have the funding all on the back of agriculture as it appears to be right now. Now, we have a long ways to go, and we have made some real progress with everybody sitting at that table. And I think if we have a little bit more time, I think by May we could have it done. But I wanted to put that to you guys to have you think about it, that is a way to initiate a program of monitoring, really see what it is we're trying to accomplish, and then broaden it from that point on. And I think it could really work. And I think the key to that is using the coalitions like we're going to set up in the newly one in Santa Barbara and San Luis, and be able to use the folks up at the six-county coalition in Monterey that already have the relationship with the farmers, work through them to pinpoint these areas, and then we can go from there. Give us 2 or 3 years to do that, and within that time, then we can develop a real monitoring program across the region. Thank you.
Joy Fitzhugh, then Don Mathis. And then Drew Bohan.
Good afternoon, Joy Fitzhugh, San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau, and thank you for allowing us to once again talk before you and express our interest and our concerns. One thing that doesn't relate to what I put in the letter here is the discussion. There was comment about organic farms, and there is no problem with pollution. As much as we would like to believe that, there are issues as much in each type of agriculture, and it's how we all handle what we put on our land. And so that I think all of us in agriculture are interested in keeping those as low as possible. And we have some very highly technologically astute individuals in agriculture today, and I think we're headed in that direction. When you receive the letter, you'll notice I have 2 points only that I'm going to be talking about from the letter today, and one is based upon the negative deck. And I brought this up at our last panel meeting so that the staff is aware of it. But one part of the negative deck
Table G, or Appendix G rather, speaks to you have to include the impact to agricultural land, prime land, land of statewide significance or of importance, unique importance, as to whether this action is going to impact it into changing it from agricultural production to some other use. And as you heard me talk last time, if you have a program that is too bureaucratically or financially impactive, you are going to have your small farmers going out of business. So I think, as Kevin was talking ahead of me, and I think I agree with him in many ways, you have to look at this as you go through the negative deck and mitigate the fact that you may have some serious impacts to our small agricultural community. And then my second point, Kevin said fairly well, and that is it's kind of like a pilot project. Start with these two entities. Let's get the wrinkles out. There's funding there to do it. The funding that you folks in, I believe it was in Santa Barbara, maybe it was here, authorized for the Santa Barbara South San Luis Obispo program, which sounds like a marvelous program, and also in the Monterey area where you have the PG&E mitigation funds. So let's look toward those and see if we can make that work first. Thank you.
Thank you. Don Mathis, then Drew Bohan.
Good afternoon, members of the board and public. My name is Don Mathis. I'm here with the Coalition of Central Coast County Farm Bureaus, also a member of the Ag Advisory Panel. It is our understanding, and I'm going to expand on comments from Kevin and Joy specifically related to monitoring. It is our understanding that monitoring is not only a legal requirement, but also an integral component of assessing the effectiveness of the waiver program. We believe that monitoring is essential for any program intended to protect water quality. Growers involved in the coalition are encouraged to voluntarily conduct water quality monitoring in their watersheds, and if appropriate, on water leaving their farms. We have partnered with various agencies and organizations to do this, and we find that the monitoring results are critical for growers to assess agricultural impacts to water quality. The information gleaned from the results can be used to make on-farm management decisions, and interestingly, my main point is that the monitoring protocol to provide this level of information for growers need not be costly or cumbersome. So I would like to propose a couple of ideas that the panel has started to discuss and evaluate. The first idea that we've started to discuss is the identification and analysis of all of the existing monitoring programs currently underway on the Central Coast. We believe that this is a critical infrastructural support that the board and its staff needs to have as a tool to implement future monitoring programs. We don't know what monitoring is going on out there. If we do, we have a peripheral understanding of it. We think that it's critical for the data to be gathered and analyzed in a regional database such that data that's gathered by CSUMB, by UC Santa Cruz, UC Davis, the pesticide data reporting, it can all be gathered into one regional database and used. This is the only way that we can effectively and efficiently put together an additional monitoring program. Simultaneously, we propose that you recommend the development and implementation of two specific monitoring programs focused on the problem areas. There are settlement funds through Guadalupe, as Kevin mentioned, and also PG&E settlement funds in Monterey. Both of those areas represent problem areas. We can get growers on board to work with the agency staff as well as with the scientists to create a monitoring program. And essentially what this would do is it would establish the protocol and would establish the guidelines of the monitoring program and how the feedback mechanisms would work. Once we work out the kinks of those two monitoring programs and develop something workable on a local level, we can use that to apply to the problem areas region-wide. That's the crux. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for coming. Thanks.
I just have
a question
for staff.
Okay.
Do we have all the data?
We have some of the larger, more significant databases. There are a lot of small efforts. There are a lot of grant-funded efforts that go on for a couple of years. There are very few long-term programs, and there's almost no programs that do toxicity or pesticide monitoring on an ongoing basis other than our own. So there are pieces out there, and there are certain watersheds that are well monitored.
particularly if we were just looking at nutrients and conventional pollutants. The data quality is highly variable. A lot of the programs are volunteer programs. Whether we'd want to use that, you know, for regulatory purposes, I think, is in question. There are a lot of, for example, DPR will do studies. They'll come in and look at a specific problem, but not maintain an ongoing effort. We've begun to compile a fairly lengthy matrix of the monitoring efforts that are out there. It's not complete yet, but it's long. But when you really start looking at how many of them are ongoing and of professional quality, there really aren't that many. But we have begun to collect some of those databases. For example, the County of Santa Cruz has a good long-term ongoing monitoring program. But like I said, there's virtually no toxicity monitoring on an ambient basis outside of our program. And I'm including our cooperators, the Granite Canyon Marine Pollution Studies Laboratory. So,
have you looked at some of this other data?
Yeah, yes.
And does it contradict any of the data that we are relying upon to move forward?
No, I'd say it supports it. For example, Elkhorn Slough has a wonderful volunteer monitoring program that, you know, points to some of the severe nutrient problems in the lower Salinas area that's been going on longer than my program has. So,
it would be significant if there was data out there that showed there wasn't an impact in a water body or an area, and the data we have shows that there is an impact. I mean, that would at least give me pause. I just would want to know why.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the quality of the data.
The other thing is that some of the monitoring programs are really taking a different tack. Like there's some stormwater monitoring in the Santa Barbara area that we don't do, and they are doing some pesticide monitoring and seeing pesticides coming off of urban areas. So there's that type of thing which is augmenting. So we don't have that type of capability in our program. Okay. But, you know, I haven't seen any contradictions per se.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Drew Bowen. I'm Executive Director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. We've been a part of this process for the last year as well, off and on, but part of it throughout. I really just want to talk about one point after saying I think staff has done a great job of really getting us to where we are. But the big white elephant or 800-pound gorilla or whatever you want to call it that everybody so far has talked about and probably a lot of the other speakers will as well is monitoring. Karen and Dave Paradis, her staff, are known statewide because I work with a number of other water quality groups as being sort of the gurus of water quality monitoring. So we've got the data set. Karen may either be, I don't know if she's just being, not wanting to toot her own horn, but it's really known as a very high quality one. The big question, though, with monitoring is what's the point? Why are we talking about monitoring? Why are we going through all this? And the point, of course, is that monitoring is just a tool to help us achieve water quality standards. So we go out and monitor, we find out where the problems are, and then we try to fix the problems. So we think there's enough monitoring done so far to really get us started off a little ahead of the game. We know where some of the problems are, and we agree with some of the prior speakers, Mr. Merrill and the former speaker just before me, that maybe we can really target it and then look at triggers and try to find those areas where the problems are the worst and maybe hit those first and then have some process to move back up the chain to find out where the exact problems are. And as the growers have been telling us all along, there are in any given watershed a couple growers who are causing some problems, and the vast majority of them are not. And I'm sure if ag is like any other industry, that's true. The big issue I think you're going to probably hear from a lot of folks is money. Monitoring, of course, is costly. So we would suggest we focus on that type of monitoring that gets us at those problem areas. Mr. Young pointed out certain nut growers don't use much water. Maybe that's the case, and maybe those oughtn't be focused on. There's no reason to have everybody do monitoring just for the sake of it. We could do individual monitoring, spend a ton of money, and not get anywhere. So we think you need to do, as the board, focus on water quality standards, and now is the time to direct staff. What is it you want in the next couple of months? But really, staff at this stage needs direction because monitoring has been that thing that's been sitting there throughout this whole process, and it's nobody – this isn't putting blame on anyone. We just haven't really gotten there yet. But I think now's the time to get some direction from the board to say, this is what we want. And I think what we want is some mechanism, and there's a bunch of ways to do it, but to go from general results that have a bunch of contributors up above to whatever triggers there are when we get a really bad situation, to move up the ladder and try to identify those sources. And it could be done by putting the onus on the growers themselves to identify those folks, or doing further monitoring and have the costs borne by those areas that are the worst. But no sense in making everybody pay a whole bunch of money for no good reason. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair? Mr. Press?
Yeah, I'm hearing, Drew, maybe you want to come back for a second. I'm hearing a lot about monitoring or looking at hotspots, to put it another way. But maybe we could get a little input from you, staff, or council about whether the law that requires us to re-examine this allows us to treat people differently with respect to monitoring requirements. And that to me is not crystal clear. Can you, in other words, can you ask monitoring of some people but not others who are all under the conditional waiver?
You can, because it's clear that you can do monitoring on a watershed basis or a sub-watershed basis. The monitoring just has to be sufficient to demonstrate that the program's working. So if you do watershed monitoring and it shows that there's no problem, that's adequate. If one person wants to step up and do the monitoring for a whole watershed, then if that's the way you want to go with the waiver, then that's legally adequate, as long as once problems are identified, there's some follow-up monitoring to find out why there's a problem, who's causing the problem, whether it's because BMPs aren't adequate or they're not being implemented, or maybe a particular operation needs a different type of regulation. But not every single person has to do his or her own monitoring.
I have a follow-up to that. I think we're getting kind of two different notions of this kind of selective monitoring. One is this notion that Drew had mentioned about, you know, trying to find the hot spots. And another variant that we just heard was you monitor based on where there's free money to do it. And is that legal to say, well, we're going to monitor in this watershed because we have money to do it, but we're not going to monitor in that watershed because that would cost money, and so we're not going to do it there?
Well, that's a little more of a problem.
Okay. You have more?
Yeah. My question really then, Lori, is we have to do monitoring, but is it legally defensible to just pick, say, two hot spots in the Central Coast region that have known impacts and use those as the protocols, I mean the test monitoring areas, and work on those for a year or so and develop a monitoring program that we would then try to replicate throughout the region? Can we do that? In other words, and everyone else would have to be enrolled, but some of those people may not be involved in any monitoring.
Well, the State Board made it clear in the recent order that you can have a phased program, and they were looking at a different type of phased program because there's going to be monitoring in all the areas. The requirements or the monitoring requirements will be phased, and what people have to do in response to the monitoring information is phased. So you could treat it as a phased program if the issue is that starting to do any other type of monitoring wouldn't really be useful to determine whether the program is adequate and whether it's working. I mean, I don't think the law requires you to have monitoring that's useless, as Mr. Bowen was saying. Targeting monitoring in particular areas just because there happens to be money in those areas, I don't think is defensible.
But how about, I mean, that might be only one component. Let's say we had a watershed working group in that area that had connections with lots of growers, so they could facilitate a monitoring program and could get funds, and it happens to overlap with hotspots. And so we want to use that as the demonstration.
I don't think there's anything preventing you from using that as the demonstration and focusing the first efforts in that area where there's known problems, but I don't think that you can use that as an excuse to completely relieve monitoring obligations in other areas.
Okay.
You could have different time schedules if, you know, if problems haven't been identified yet, they would be in a different stage of a monitoring program. A watershed would be in a different stage of monitoring, and maybe the requirements would be different if you don't know yet whether there's a problem. You know, you would want to target some enforcement where you know, not enforcement, but oversight or more work where you know there's problems, but I don't think you can just ignore every place else.
So are you advising us then that those areas where we have known water quality impacts, that we have the opinion is connected at least in part to agriculture, that we need to implement some type of monitoring?
Yes.
At this point, in those areas where we don't have data, we could phase those in at a later point in time.
You could phase in the requirements. I wouldn't delay the starting date indefinitely.
Well, I mean, have them enrolled, but phase in the monitoring requirement.
For example, have a requirement that a monitoring plan was due in 6 months or a year, and the first report was due a year after that, which is basically...
Well, I mean, something like that. I'm just trying to look at how we might do a phased approach.
That would be one way to do it. And I think we need more technical input from staff, because basically the legal requirement is the monitoring has to be adequate to determine whether the program is working and whether it's an appropriate way to regulate water quality. And that's largely a technical determination. Obviously, if you know there's a hot spot and there's no monitoring, then that's not sufficient monitoring to determine whether the program is working. And you have more flexibility in areas, either where it's not likely that there's any problem or where it's just completely unknown.
Okay. So if I can reiterate that, it sounds like it's okay to do phased approach to the whole program.
Yes.
There's a difficulty saying you have to monitor, but you won't have to monitor for 5 years. So doing selective phasing isn't. We can certainly concentrate monitoring in hot spots, but you can't say, okay, well, just monitor here and not monitor there at all. So is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify my point since we've talked about
it now? You called him up. Do you want him to clarify your point?
I didn't call him. Mr. Jeffries.
No, you called
Mr.
him.
Mr. Preston.
Oh,
Daniel.
Yes, please clarify your point.
Thank you very much. I'd like to clarify my point. Channel Keeper would believe that monitoring should be done at all the sites that have been identified. I think it was something like 50. But then what we're proposing is if 28 of them or 38 of them show very low hits on the constituents of concern in those water bodies, then maybe they only need to be monitored once every year or once every 2 years, versus the ones that are 10 times the limits, maybe those need to go once a month or twice a month. But a one-size-fits-all is unduly painful to some and maybe not rigorous enough for others.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let the record show that Dr. Les Balker is here in attendance now. Hi, Les. Staff has a...
I was just going to comment that the way the cooperative program is envisioned, it is structured into it that we're doing more monitoring in our priority areas. So that's how this network of sites was selected. Where are 303D listed waters? Where are our groundwater problems in the areas? Outside of that, we're relying on CCAMP data to help us understand emerging problems. And then in the cooperative program, we've built in a 25% follow-up, into the budget, so that where we identify problems, we can go and go upstream and look for in more detail. Mm-hmm. So some of what he was speaking to was
already
addressed
envisioned
in the program.
Yes, thank you.
No, one thought I had, is Mary here? You know, Mary's...
Bianchi.
The program.
Bianchi, Mary?
Yeah, is it Mary Bianchi? Who runs the education?
The short
program.
Course, you mean?
The short
that's
course.
Right, that's right.
Yes. Guess not.
Maybe she's not here, but as part of that process, you know, they develop the farm water quality plan. I wonder if they're also looking at where would be the most likely places on that farm to do water quality sampling.
Yeah. Part of their plan, part of their assessment, and looking at, because there is a component where people do self-monitoring, learn some techniques for self-monitoring. So, yeah, they would identify those kinds of places.
Okay.
All right, let's move on with cards here. John Snyder, then Stephanie Wald, then Chris Darway. You have 3 minutes, sir.
Oh, thank you. My name is John Snyder. My wife and I run a nursery in Napomo. Could I please have the slide that showed the water quality displayed? I went, I'm new to this, so you can bear with me here. I'd like to talk about document R3-2004XYZ. I went onto the website today to bone up on this. I live in Napomo. I'm not in a watershed. I pump groundwater and use it in a nursery operation. And so we're hydroponic, so we apply no water to the ground. So I went to this document here that says, can I be exempt? And then I went to find R3-2004-XXX to see what that might entail for me. That's not available on the website, and it was not available prior to the meeting, so I would like the chance to come back when an actual document is available that we can comment on.
Sure.
Secondly, I find that there's an awful lot of terminology here that seems to be poorly identified, and I couldn't find any list of terms and definition of terms, like farming and irrigating. Those seem to be very obscure as to me in this text. I don't know where my graph is on water quality and groundwater basins, but groundwater, sorry, yeah. I live in that cluster of dots and nursery right there. No, down a little lower, right there on the Napomo Mesa. And so in terms of this, I was looking at number 11 here, and it says one of the objectives of this is that, or not the objectives, but one of the things here is that it's not expected that dischargers will achieve full compliance with all of the conditions immediately. And I think you should have rules that you can reasonably expect the majority of the people who are under this to can comply with them, and I think that's important. And thinking about that being in the middle of a bunch of red dots, you'd mentioned that you're not going to monitor water quality. So I have no, I'm not in any watershed. I don't have any runoff, so I don't know how I fit in the monitoring program if I have nothing to monitor, unless you're talking about the water that comes off the greenhouse roof, goes into a pipe, into a drainage pit, and then every winter is filled with ducks who do what ducks do. And I'm sure the nitrate levels are unacceptable in that pond, but it's very natural. It's natural nitrate, so that's not clear. And the other thing that confuses me is that in this very same area, approximately 2 years ago, I believe it was the Regional Water Quality Control Board that allowed a doubling of the density of the septic tanks in that area, which increased the development of houses and has a tremendous potential to increase nitrate. So how, you know, I don't want to be responsible, of course, for a bunch of septic tanks. How is this plan going to separate that out? I couldn't find that on the website, and I'd like a chance to comment on that when there's some plan on that.
Okay. Thanks for those questions.
Right. I've been red-lighted. Thank you.
If I could just make a comment, this is not the best forum to have this kind of exchange, and staff can help you with all of that, you know, before you come to a board meeting. Especially finding documents which may or may not be on the website. But, Allison, did you want to address anything? I think there's some misconceptions about what we're attempting to do with groundwater and why we're not requiring it to be monitored, but why someone might be in the program.
People would be in the program if they have discharges either of irrigation, runoff, or potentially discharges to groundwater. Now, if you're fully contained greenhouse without any kind of soil floor, then it wouldn't be included in this program.
Well, it depends on how you define fully contained.
Well,
is that like one atom gets out, then I'm in, or you know, two atoms?
Well, are you talking about a greenhouse operation?
Yes.
No, nothing outside, just within a greenhouse.
We do have, of course, trees outside that are to keep the neighbors from being bothered as part of our local plan to help be good with neighbors. So, and we do fertilize those, of course, as our landscape, you know, landscape is irrigated.
Do you have a cement floor to the greenhouse, or is it ground?
Neither.
What is the substrate?
Well, the substrate is coconut. It's grown in plastic buckets. Beneath the plastic buckets are plastic troughs, and beneath that is a fabric material, and beneath that is the soil.
Can your water get into the soil, your irrigation water?
Yeah, say you have like 2,000 buckets and one of the nozzles falls off, yes.
But as a matter of course, the answer is no. We're not trying to be crazy here. If it's designed so that water tends not to get into the ground, then...
Okay, well...
I mean, if you put a pot there with a hole in the bottom so that the water naturally falls through the pot into the ground...
It's designed to contain the water.
Okay, good.
But then am I in because of my I irrigate the trees outside and for the landscaping?
I would doubt it. I certainly wouldn't put you in.
Okay, well,
for that reason.
That's where I think that maybe that we need a clarification of terms because it's not at all clear.
I mean, if you had a nursery where you're raising trees, that would be different. But if you have a few landscape trees out front, just like a house does.
Well, it's about 300, but there are 300 landscape trees. So once again, I think, really you need some definition of the terms here because it's really confusing.
Well, you're never going to get this completely defined. What if you have 306 trees and... Well, it's going to be a case-by-case basis. Staff will look at things, and you're right that we need to have better kinds of determinations of what tends to be in and what not tends not to be in, but it's always kind of a judgment call.
I understand that, but I'm just requesting that
there
be more definition.
Clarification is good.
Thank you.
I'm not against clarification. Thank you. Stephanie Wall, then Chris Darway, then Keith Miller.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stephanie Wald, and I'm representing Central Coast Salmon Enhancement. We work in the Pismo, Arroyo Grande, and Napomo watersheds with private and public landowners to reduce inputs into waterways. We conduct volunteer citizen water quality monitoring in all three watersheds for nutrients and have established citizen-based working groups for ongoing dialogues. We currently are funded for just Napomo and Arroyo Grande, but our goal is to assess all three and produce iterative management plans with prioritized recommended projects, then pursue implementation for the projects with partners with evaluation elements as part of these implementation plans for adaptive management. We're concerned that the Ag Waiver Program come on in line in concert with these efforts to be most effective, and they be supportive of a combination of education, good science, and compliance using the tiered approach. One of our major projects is rearing and releasing salmon in San Luis Bay, so we have a deep interest in protecting the water quality of the bay's watersheds. We look forward to working with the regional board as you proceed in the transition of ag waivers. Thanks.
Thank you. Chris Darway, then Keith Miller, then Laura Plaskett.
Good afternoon, members. As an Indian Valley farmer, I farm 31 different ag properties. These properties range in size from 3 acres to 220 acres. My operations are also in multiple watersheds. Some of these fields actually drain into three different watersheds. My concerns relate to the monitoring options. If I individually monitor my properties under the standards set by the regional staff, as I understand it, I would have in excess of $310,000 in monitoring costs annually. I say this because I would have to monitor the water both incoming and outgoing to see what my contributions to that would be. These costs far exceed my profits realized from my operation. If I chose to monitor through the statewide program, I'm concerned they'd be required to pay, once again, on 31 different sites. If the program ranges in fees from approximately $100 for 10 acres or less, or $1,000 for 1,000 acres or more, I've calculated I'd pay $3,000 to $5,000 annually for this. Again, this would be a tremendous expense to my operation. For an example, San Luis Obispo County Farmers Markets farmers have the same issues as I just spoke about. Most of them farm on relatively small operations in multiple sites. I'm concerned about the expense in this monitoring. And also would like to bring up that the farms in San Luis Obispo County are somewhat unique, I believe, from other parts of the state. We're not 1,000-acre operations. There's a lot of small, intensive agriculture here in San Luis County, and there's numerous operations also. The expense of this monitoring operation requirements proposed on our regional staff, must be revised. The operations must relate to San Luis County's uniqueness in agriculture, and implementing and monitoring requirements in this waiver operation, I should say. I'd also like to comment that I'm encouraged about the discussion and the questions by the board. And I really appreciate that. I really do. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to make one correction to what you said. That I think the staff is not recommending individual waiver. They put that up as an example, but they definitely do not recommend it, and I personally don't either. What staff is talking about is something more like this cooperative scheme where it would be watershed scale.
Thank you.
Okay. Keith Miller and Laura Plaskett.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hearing me this morning or this afternoon. I just wanted to point out that there still is a lot of information, and you've heard about it earlier, but we haven't coordinated this plan yet, and staff doesn't have the ends tied up on this. I hold before you two reports that are filed on an annual basis in my watershed. My watershed is watched over on a controlled basis every year. $100,000 is the budget for this. It's more than we're going to get out of any kind of monitoring that we're going to do on a basis. But I'm real concerned about the broad-brushed approach that we're trying to paint agriculture with. Monitoring wouldn't do me any good at this point because this is done by an entity in a city. Therefore, that doesn't come under the purview of an agricultural idea. And I'm assuming that we're going to be made to go and re-monitor a monitor of somebody who is highly qualified or much more highly qualified than anybody that we have at this point. And we would have a bunch of redundant fees. Doesn't sound like we've gotten it all together. Some people have started to hit on this point that there is a lot of monitoring and testing out there. And before we go off onto a monitoring plan, we need to actually look at it. We need to put it back together. We need to see what monitoring needs to be done. If I understand the legislature's intent, and I think that you've seen it enough times because you've been working with it, the intent was for you to identify the sites, not for me to identify them for you to then work with those people in those sites, which is happening in the Chorro Flat and is a great idea of how this could work, and then, if that doesn't work, to monitor those sites. And I think we've taken this gigantic leap away from what the legislature intended for you to do, which was to identify, work through, and then monitor if necessary and regulate. So I implore you, take a step at this at a time. Do what is the right thing. And the other thing is, I can't afford it. I work 8 hours a day. I came here to see you folks today. I guarantee you, if they put a $1,000 bill on me to monitor that program, there is going to be more pollution because I'm going to have $1,000 less to put in a grass waterway, a rock retard, or any of the other monitoring devices that I've identified in my plan. And by the way, I am a graduate of the Ranch Water Quality Control Plan. And I've identified those, and I have money budgeted to do that. And I'm trying to be the best that I can. 96% of all steelhead in Santa Rosa Creek live from the reach below me and on up. So I just want it known that we're doing what we can up there. We need your help. We don't need to be monitored to death, and we don't need to expend all the money that's left over. I work 8 hours a day to keep that place that way. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. And thanks for your work, too. Mike and Carol Broadhurst, and then Sally Friend.
Good afternoon, Chairman Daniels and members of the board. I'm Laura Plaskett, representing clients in Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito counties, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I do concur with many of the speakers that came before me today in asking you to consider a phased-in approach for monitoring, as well as an approach that considers the existing monitoring efforts within the region so that we aren't duplicating efforts. And as has already been stated, so that we can take that money, those funds, and use them to implement on-farm practices which would help improve water quality. Monitoring in and of itself will not improve water quality, but implementation on the farm will. The State Water Resources Control Board has indicated to me that they do not plan to set waiver fees for this year, 2004. I'd ask the board to consider how this region plans to fund implementation of the Ag Waiver Program beginning October 1 with enrollment if waiver fees are in fact not set by the State Water Resources Control Board. I also had some specific questions for staff to be addressed hopefully by the March hearing. Regarding the projected costs that were published in your report for today's meeting, how did you arrive at these costs for the cost of the waiver program to small, medium, and large farming operations? Are these costs annual costs or costs for a five-year period? And are the costs based on one waiver per operation, no matter how many farms or ranches you're operating, or is it a cost per ranch or per farm in your operation? Thank you.
Thanks for those questions. Mike Broadhurst and Carol Broadhurst.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Broadhurst, and Carol and I own and operate a small farm on Santa Rosa Creek. I retired about 3 years ago, and that's when we bought the farm. Before that, I was head of research and development for Zeneca Agrochemicals, which is a $3 billion worldwide crop protection company. And as in that job, I had responsibility for everything from invention to the development of data to meet regulatory requirements. But I don't do that anymore. We try to practice integrated pest management on our farm, using cultural practices, good plant nutrition to keep the pests away. Sometimes that doesn't completely work and we have to use pesticides. And we certainly follow label directions when we use pesticides. And as you well know, the EPA and the CDPR said that those pesticides are safe when used according to the label directions. That's point one. Second point is this is complicated business, monitoring is. I know that well. Now, our being on Santa Rosa Creek, our farm is at the bottom of a long miles and miles of watershed that runs into Santa Rosa Creek. How are you going to establish a baseline for monitoring in that situation? You know, who knows what comes in and what goes out? Let's see. The third point was the intensity of agriculture on Santa Rosa Creek is minuscule compared to some of the other watersheds in your region, for instance, the Salinas Valley. And so, you know, I haven't seen the data. I would like to, but I just got involved in this process. But my suspicion is that Santa Rosa Creek is not at issue, that there are no pollutants. You know, I know the farmers up there. They all do use good practice. And at this point in time, small farms like ours, the cost base in this country for agriculture is incredible compared to what it is in some other parts of the world. You know, and we're going to get put out of business, I guarantee you, if it keeps going this way. You can regulate it to death. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol Broadhurst. And Sally Friend.
Carol Broadhurst, Dragon Spring Farm. Well, just watching what you've all been going through today, I want to say thank you for a horrendous effort on a job that appears to be almost impossible from most points of view.
That's why they pay us the big bucks.
Yeah, they used to pay him the big bucks, too, for equally difficult problems. We live on Santa Rosa Creek, which is a healthy creek for wildlife, as evidenced by the steelhead that live in the creek. We have, and we're not nearly as far up as Keith is. We're down at the near the base, and we're 5 miles from town, but we're not up high in the hills. We have adult steelhead running through our property, and we have a pond where usually we get a pair or more that live in it just under our bridge. But then just up from there, there's a beautiful little pond with a sandy beach, and there are always, every year, there has always been large schools of steelhead fingerlings in there. So as I understand it, that's like the ultimate test of a healthy creek, is if you can, aside from the birds and everybody else that eats there, we have the fish too. We irrigate completely with drip. We have no chronic runoff. The only wash through of soils is in the late winter, not even yet, but after these storms, but eventually when the soil is completely saturated, I assume we finally get some wash off of the whatever's in the soil into the creek. I believe, as Michael does, and all of the ranchers that live both upstream and downstream, that we all practice exceptionally good care, probably 100%, but very close to it. We work with Robert Stockel, which is in the same office with Mary Bianchi, and also with Ken Warren, who's the PCA at Farm Supply, that helps us all be sure we know what everything is and how it should be used. And one of the important things is when not to use it. Like, a lot of things can't be applied from October until a month after the rains. And they all make sure that each of us is very aware of those things. So we are taken well care of in this county, I believe, for some of the issues to protect all of us in this area. There obviously is a need for this law, not a new law, but to be enforced at some point. And it is a very difficult job. I have a lot of points of view on that, but it's a very difficult job, and I appreciate all of the work that you're all doing. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just have a question for staff. Is this creek a 303D listed body?
I don't believe so. It is in good shape. There is potentially a mercury problem there from old historic mercury mines, but I haven't seen any of the typical agricultural pollutants in the water column.
I mean, is this an area that might be appropriate for a lowest threat?
This area is in the area that is outside of that network of defined sites, so it's in the area that would be monitored on a less frequent basis through the CCAMP program.
I mean, if we don't have any data that suggests that it's impaired at all, or, you know, there are any water quality standards that are being exceeded, I wonder what our basis would be for wanting to do any monitoring.
I think if you want to see if you need to address any degradation, is it staying the same, is it getting worse? The idea is if we come in once every 5 years with our program, less frequently, we're able to keep a handle on it without putting a huge amount of resources in that area and using our resources. And that's kind of the point of the cooperative program, is that we're taking, combining resources to look at areas outside of the real problem areas. But right now, the fee structure is set up more on the practices you're implementing as opposed to whether you're inside or outside of the 303D listed water bodies. Or not the fee structures, I'm sorry, but the proposed costs for the monitoring.
I mean, maybe CCAMP itself would be more appropriate for a monitoring program for areas like this to get background data so we know what long-term trends are.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Okay. That's what we're doing.
Okay.
What we're proposing in the cooperative approach, that in some of the areas that just aren't, you know, obviously showing a problem at this point, we're coming in once every 5 years on our regular watershed rotation and doing the monitoring. And if we see a problem developing, so that it looks like it might need to be listed, for instance, on a 303D list, then we would consider placing sites on that water body into the monitoring network that would be more regularly monitored.
For such an area with essentially a clean bill of health, would you see little or no monitoring cost then for that area, or how would that?
Well, the cost of the cooperative program is sort of, it's a distributed cost, basically. That's why the costs are low.
But you can distribute it non-uniformly.
I'm sorry?
You could distribute it non-uniformly.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things we've been not totally reflected in that, but some other discussion that we've been starting to have is setting up sort of a, well, I want to say pyramid triangle approach, mm-hmm. where you have basically threat to water quality and you factor in different things such as practices.
Okay.
And
good. Thank you.
Right. Just the way we initially set up the budget. We did a pretty elaborate budget to try to come up with estimated costs. It's available to be, if anyone wants to play with it. But the way the initial breakdown, just, you know, as a first cut was done, was just based on, we had a tiering based on, you know, the threat of the practices or the threat to water quality. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. The other thing we haven't quite worked out but are still looking at is, you know, having a low threat or, you know, completely
waiving fees or in costs in some cases. Right, so that's still an option.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think that that would be interesting to see that as maybe as a tier three or tier, make that tier one and then two, three. I'd like to see some thought about a three-tier system with a low-threat version.
But the other point I was trying to make is that in addition to the practices that are being implemented, or in other words, is it a drip facility or is a facility with runoff? That might be an example of how you'd establish this hearing. But we could also factor in whether they're located in a problem water body.
Yeah,
or not.
A multi-factor tiering criteria makes sense to me.
Okay.
Now, as we get back to the cards, we still have quite a stack here. So, Sally Friend, Don Dunlap, and then John Beard. No Sally Friend? All right. Don Dunlap? Okay. Okay. Well, I'll keep the card. John Beard. Next will be Ray Allen Jr., then Robert Stoller.
Hi there. Good evening. Good afternoon. I'm from Santa Cruz County. I have a small nursery in the Soquel. And I was want to speak on behalf of the small ranches and small farmers, and that we hope you'll be as fair and equitable with the costs of monitoring and waivers as you can. I just recently finished the 15-hour classes for the ag farm plan, and I don't know how you're going to reach out and get all of the ranchers and farmers and nurserymen into these classes. There's only the class I took, there was 30 people, and that's San Benito, Monterey, and Santa Cruz County is a small portion of the ranches out there. And if these people are to complete the classes within before October, I don't know how you're going to even reach all these people by that time. This isn't in the newspaper, it's not in the mail. I don't know what to. These laws have been around for a long time, and we all are unaware of them. I only found out this fall. So I ask for a little leniency and the way you structure this so that we all have time and money to stay in business after the laws are implemented. Thank you.
Thank you. Ray Allen Jr., then Robert Stoller, then Gene Miskelin.
I'm Ray Allen. I'm chairman of the Water Committee for the San Luis Obispo County Cattlemen. And it's not too often that I find myself in agreement with Eric Cardenas and Drew, but I really have to I have to admit that I agree with their approach to this. And so let me read my comments. It's unanimous consensus of the Board of Directors that the conditional waiver as proposed goes far beyond what's necessary to achieve the goal of protecting and enhancing the waters of the region. The ag community should be recognized as one of the foremost advocates of clean water, since they are one of the first affected by it and depend on it for their livelihood. As proposed, this is not a waiver. Instead, it would take the format of what has been a voluntary program and turn it into a regulatory structure of reporting, monitoring, and expense that many farmers can ill afford. Current laws authorize the regional board to take certain actions and initiate fees. As I understand it, those laws do not mandate farm plans, education, nor fees. The law does require the regional board to ensure clean water and to take action where there is known impairment. Instead of a whole new regulatory structure and reinventing the wheel, the regional board would would fulfill its obligation by concentrating on those areas of known impairment and take action as necessary. Ambient monitoring by CCAMP has identified those areas. Follow up with site-specific monitoring in order to identify what is actually agricultural problems. because there is a mix. And we would suggest that rather than have a total program at this point in time that is trying to solve every answer every problem that agriculture and staff and environmentalists have at this point in time, that you do the a phase-in approach. So you deal with the problem areas that have already been identified and take action. Nobody wants clean water more than farmers do. And I would suggest that that the board staff create a list of the problems that are perceived to be ag-driven, and a list of the practices that they'd like to have and the goals that they'd like to pursue for ag community, and then disseminate that information to the ag community, to the ag organizations.
Sorry,
I know that
up.
The ag community would rather be proactive than they would be defensive, but at this point in time, I'm afraid we're in a defensive mode.
Thank you for your comments. Robert Stoller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Bob Stoller. We farm avocados about 3 miles east of the city of Morro Bay. And you have two letters that my wife and I have submitted to the board. I'd like to have you refer to those as well. But I'd like to talk specifically about the options for water quality monitoring. This draft that was dated 12/29. The year 2003, just a few months ago. On the page 4 of the attachment 2, it gives us a monitoring option in terms of the types of tests would have to, would have to be undertaken. This was submitted to one of the certified laboratories we work with on a regular basis for our water testing, our soil testing, leaf petiole analysis. This one came from the Creek Environmental Laboratories. And to do this once a year would cost us $15,450. Now, having been in agriculture for the last 53 years, outside of some notable exceptions of marketing cooperatives, for instance, Sunkist, Calavo, Calcott, Diamond Walnut, and so on, the propensity of farmers to cooperate has never been terribly remarkable. Generally, they're pretty much independent, and so even though there's some optimism here about getting the people together to do this, that, and the other thing, I'm not so excited about the success of that idea. So I figure that in connection with the fact that we're irrigating maybe 30 times a year with our avocados, and we straddle Morro Creek and Highway 41, we'd be probably pretty well disposed to do some of our own testing at a cost of over $15,000 a year. Now, if you capitalize that, we would have to magically increase our market in gross income by over $250,000 at 6%. Or if you give us, say, 10 years' time to take $25,000 off the top of our thing and invest it in a 6% investment over a 10-year period, we have accumulated around $250,000. And if that gives us 6%, we can pay the $15,000 that this costs. I think that this is a question that you gentlemen should kind of roll around in your minds in terms of what the real cost to our operation, and I'm sure many of these others would be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Sir, are those comments addressed in a letter you said was submitted to
us? No, the two letters have something else.
Okay. How many acres do you farm?
We farm 348 acres, of which around 220 are planted avocados.
Okay. And the $15,000 monitoring cost is something that you've derived from where?
Well, you're going to have copies of this. I think that Karen's going to be giving you copies of this. This is from Crick Environmental Labs, and I think we have some substantiating laboratories as well. For instance, Fruit Growers Laboratory, which we all use as well, Santa Paula. These are certified labs. And the breakdown is right here in this, which you're going to get a copy of.
Okay.
The toxicity testing is very expensive. That's why we're not recommending we do our monitoring at the level of the individual, because it's prohibitive. We agree with him.
Have you seen his numbers?
Yeah. No, but we did estimates and came up with 10 to 12 per site, which is why we're proposing vastly fewer sites in a watershed-style
okay.
approach.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next is Jean Mulshow. Terrible with this name, unfortunately.
Mr. Chairman and board members, thank you for having your meeting here close to us so we are easy to travel to. My name is Jean Malskow. My family and I farm 200 acres of lemons and avocados in the Napoma foothills. The young orchards are irrigated by drip, and the mature trees by many sprinklers. We have no runoff from the irrigated site. We contract every year with Fruit Growers Lab out of Santa Paula for our nutritional requirements. They take leaf samples in the fall, soil samples in the spring. From that, then they advise us on our nutrition program, NPK and all the minors. We put a little bit of nitrogen in the soil, in the water that goes in the soil for the lemons and avocados. On the avocados, we have to put some zinc in the soil because they're high users of zinc. All the rest of the N, P, and K is put on foliarly, and all the minors are put on by foliar. Most of it done when we do our pest control. We are, in lemons, we are now controlling almost all of our pests with just spray oil, two spray oils a year. And very seldom do we have to go to any stronger chemicals. So we're very cognizant of the cost of these materials, and we're only putting on what they feel that should be put on, and because they're very expensive, and it's wasteful to go beyond that. We're also putting mulch in the tree rows, about a 12-foot swath, which is green waste that we haul from the landfills, and we've been doing that now for 2 years, and then out in the row we seed a grass mixture of some sort for a grassy area where the machines travel and everything, and then we mow that in the spring and summer, and leave a stubble there that helps hold the soil for the first rains that come in the next winter. The problem that I see here is that these things are very expensive, and any cost of monitoring or what have you is going to take away from some of the things that we're doing. Mm-hmm. On our ranch, we have three creeks that come through our ranch. I took your short course, and they advise that we monitor the stream when it comes into the ranch and when we leave. That's six monitoring sites, and if it's going to run 10,000, 15,000 per site, you're talking about a lot of loose change here. So, which we can't afford that, and if that is going to be the case, then it's going to take away from some of these other things that we're trying to do to preserve the soil. Oh, and another thing we do, we have grass waterways. Where water does run, we have grass waterways before it enters the creek.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Teresa McQueen, Jackie Crabb, and Bob Lilly.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa McQueen. I'm an attorney from Irvine, California, and I'm here on behalf of the California Avocado Commission and the avocado growers of the Central Coast region. Because the draft resolution now at issue before the board proposes, among other things, the monitoring and regulation of waste discharge and property access requirements for agricultural growers, we at the commission feel it is important that the board have a better understanding of how such water regulation affects avocado farming. California Avocado Commission is a state government agency which represents the interest of its industry's 6,000 growers and packers. Over 100 of these growers live and work on family farms here in San Luis Obispo County, with many of these same growers also farming citrus, cut flowers, and other high-value crops. Water represents as much as 60% of the cost of growing avocados. It is the most costly input for our growers, and unlike other sectors of agriculture, avocados can only be grown in coastal, central, and southern California locations, from San Luis Obispo to San Diego, where water costs can exceed $800 per acre foot. Consequently, avocado growers are highly efficient water users. Virtually all avocado growers have invested in state-of-the-art micro-sprinklers and drip irrigation systems that apply only as much water as are needed by the trees. It is important for the board to recognize that these practices differ from other types of farming operations that generate significant water runoff. Avocado growers must also be vigilant to guard against pest and disease infestation. If these occur, operating costs greatly increase and farm operations are placed at risk. One disease, root rot, is particularly insidious because it can be easily transmitted from orchard to orchard by equipment and personnel. This devastating fungus can decimate orchards and render countless acres useless for future avocado plantings. Understandably, growers are greatly concerned about unescorted access to their properties, which might unknowingly spread this disease. In conclusion, I'd like to say that avocado growers pride themselves on being responsible stewards of the environment. The industry has received acclaim for its innovative techniques in integrated pest management, resulting in some of the lowest pesticide use by any agricultural product in California. The industry provides positive societal and environmental benefits through the creation of open space and habitat, a welcome contrast in our increasingly urban landscapes. We hope the board will consider these unique aspects of avocado farming when it contemplates its draft resolution. The commission will be forwarding more detailed comments in writing to the board within the next few weeks. Thank you.
Thank you. Jackie Crabb and Bob Lilly and Karen Mansfield.
Good afternoon. My name is Jackie Crabb. I'm with the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. I have brought a letter to you today from one of our members, Rick Fuller, with Continental Vineyard, who wasn't able to make it today. I'd like to highlight two concerns he has. It is about the data that will be collected for monitoring and some questions he has about how that will be evaluated. His first concern, San Luis Obispo is an area of climatic variability. How does the board plan to take this into account? Surely, if three dry years are followed by one wet year, this can change the composition of the runoff water in the wet year. The second point, he had personally sent identical samples to two different well-known laboratories for duplicate analysis and received back two entirely different reports. He would like to know how you plan to address these variabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Lilly and Karen Mansfield, then Bob Rose. Yes.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Bob Lilly, County Ag Commissioner. I addressed the board in Salinas, so I'll try not to repeat what I said there, and I'd like to thank the board for holding this additional workshop in San Luis Obispo. As you can see, there, we have a lot of interest with our local growers here as well. Understandably, there has to be some key components of this new program affecting agriculture. Prevention, of course, is a really key component in prevention of water quality impacts. Training and farm plans are a key component to this, and I think you have a fairly good buy-in from the ag industry on that, and I think we have a really good start in that area. And I would also like to request the board to consider some sort of a certification program for watershed groups similar to the one that Kevin Merrill was talking about, might be a way to create some efficiencies and economy of scale. Of course, compliance is an important part of the Water Qualities Board's mission and Roger's staff, and if there's problems, then you know, the regulatory portion is there to deal with that. The monitoring, as you've been hearing, I think is really a key issue to all this, and I think it's really important to continue the deliberation on who pays, where the monitoring is done, and what components are you monitoring for. It would seem to me justified to use regional board funds to do background, baseline, and database collection type monitoring throughout the watershed, and it doesn't seem that agriculture should be saddled with a blanket expense to come up with background or baseline type data that's going to be used to make decisions by the regional board staff and the regional board. As Karen mentioned, there's really limited data for pesticides, currently limited to no data for toxicity, and it seems to me that that should be the regional board's job to determine what the background levels are, or if there's a problem at all, and not saddle the ag industry with that expense. Obviously, there's other sources of pollution as well besides agriculture. As you know, there's a lot of pesticides and fertilizers that are used in urban areas. I would hope that if you're going to be applying fees, that they can be applied uniformly to other sources and not have to have agriculture take on the full burden of the fees. Finally, I've worked with the county here and with the farming community for 26 years now, and we've implemented many new regulatory programs on the farming community. None of them are very fun. As Bob Stoller said, that's usually the reaction we get. But it's been our experience that if you can get cooperation from the agricultural industry in implementing a new program, that's key to the success. And a phased-in approach is typically how we would do that, with education first and then focusing on problem areas. Thank you.
Thanks. I have a question. You mentioned the kinds of monitoring you thought we should handle with all of our excess regional board funds. What sorts of monitoring do you think are reasonable for a farming community to take on?
It seems to me that to develop a database of background impacts to water quality would be the regional board's function.
Yeah,
I
understand that.
Once there's a problem identified, then I feel that it would be appropriate to charge the polluter that's contributing to the problem.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
But don't you agree with the high nitrate level maps that we have from data that shows that there's high nitrate levels throughout the region that overlap in areas where there's ag?
If ag's a contributing source, then that's...
Isn't that your understanding also of that data?
I'm not an expert on the nitrate data, so I'm not qualified to speak to that.
Okay, but you are the ag commissioner, right, for San Luis Obispo County.
Been called worse.
Yeah, we have data that shows nitrate levels which are elevated. I think a lot of that... a lot of those areas don't really overlap with urban areas, especially in the Central Coast region, that we're not heavily urbanized like Southern California. I mean, the L.A. Basin, San Diego.
And where we are, it tends to be right on the water.
Yeah, exactly. The nitrate testing would seem to be kind of an appropriate thing to request. I mean, would you agree?
I would
with
agree
that?
If there's a nexus there. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Next, Karen Mansfield, then Bob Rose, then Deb Robinson.
Karen Mansfield. I'm the executive director of the San Luis Obispo County Agricultural Task Force. Bob Stoller is a member of our organization. This graph, as crude as it is, defines the costs that he quoted to you. We took the information that was on page 4, attachment 2, dated 12/29/03 in your packet that preceded the Salinas workshop. We submitted the items listed there for the monitoring, proposed monitoring, to two certified labs named here at the bottom. These were the price quotes that we received for a watershed group. If there's only one member in that watershed group, that one member will be paying the $15,000. If there are three, obviously you break that cost down among three. It's still very costly. I know that the members of our organization, we have greenhouse growers, we have avocado growers, we have vineyard participants. They're very sophisticated in how they run their operations. They do not want to squander their resources to overuse pesticides and fertilizers. They don't want to damage their crops with overuse. I think they're good stewards of the land, and I don't think that the broad brush approach that all of farming is guilty until proven innocent is the right approach. Thank you. And we've distributed letters to you. We submitted a letter to you in January, provide you copies today, along with copies of the two creek and fruit growers' labs of the test, the quotes that they gave us. Thank you.
I certainly don't disagree with that. In fact, that's why, our staff does not support individual monitoring. I certainly don't. And we'll see how much the board does, but certainly it's not a way we want to go.
I'm very encouraged with the comments that you've been making today compared to what I heard in Santa Barbara and Salinas. I think you're in the right direction.
Great. Thank you.
We're just getting warmed up.
Bob Rose, then Deb Robinson, then Mark Wright. Is Bob Rose here? He's had to leave. Deb Robinson? There she is.
Hi. I'm Deb Robinson. I'm with Environmental Information Services in Lompoc, and I just want to talk a little bit about some successful IPM strategies that city and farming communities have adopted in various areas. One good news item was last Tuesday night, actually a week ago, in Santa Barbara, the Santa Barbara City Council voted unanimously to adopt a citywide IPM program, and that also included a long-term goal for pesticide-free Santa Barbara for the future. Now, this process was a three-year process. It was mostly educational. It included city personnel, private industry, environmental groups, and individuals. And they, 3 years ago, the primary tools that they had to work with in landscape maintenance were chemical fertilizers and pesticides. That was our knowledge base. So we worked real hard to learn safer alternatives, of which they did. And they set up demonstration IPM sites in schools, homes, farms, and public places like parks. And it was quite successful. And because of that, they were able to come to this unanimous decision. Now, three resources that we all can use, and that's what I wanted to tell you about, was the Green Gardener, Certified Green Gardener program in Santa Barbara. Basically, it's a 10-session course. I've taken it myself. It's excellent. It's bilingual. They teach it at least twice a year. 75 to 100 professionals, farming and landscaping professionals, take it each time. And they provide basic information in natural soil fertility factors, how to obtain it, natural pest control, and the different irrigation ways. The next resource that I wanted to tell you about is the Regional IPM Coalition. And it's available for everyone. Professionals work with this. And the highlight of the last meeting was that UCSB has decided to discontinue the use of Roundup and pre-emergent herbicides due to toxic runoff and adverse impact on sea life. The other opportunity is right here in at Cal Poly, and that's the SARC program, Sustainable Agriculture Resource Center. They have a working organic farm. They sell to restaurants, individuals, and at the farmers markets. Everybody's can take courses and workshops there, both for enrolled students as well as community members in sustainable organic agriculture. And I invite everyone to take advantage of all these resources. Thanks.
Thank you. Mark Wright, then David O'Dell, and Emily Harrison. Is there a Mark Wright here? Guess not. David O'Dell? Emily Harrison? Boy, going quick now. Adriana? Pardon? Emily Hansen, right? Okay. And I was on a roll there. Next will be Adriana Morales.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Emily Hansen, here with the Resource Conservation District of Monterey County. And I'm not here to talk about monitoring. I'm here to talk about the costs of practice implementation as well as the resources available to farmers to implement practices. First, I'd like to talk a little bit. You guys have heard a lot from staff and from other public members commenting on the availability of resource conservation districts and NRCS within Region 3 to provide technical assistance, be it through farm water quality short courses, conservation planning, plan implementation, and construction inspection, et cetera, to farmers in the region. And I wanted to just give you guys kind of a dose of reality on really what our resources are that are available. I made a few phone calls this morning, and throughout Region 3, NRCS has about 13 technical staff to be able to help farmers. Of that, they have three engineers able to work on irrigated ag land within your region. They have three vacancy positions of engineering within the region as well. The resource conservation districts within this region do not have any engineers. We have hydrologists, we have some water quality specialists, some conservation planners, and other staffers that are able to provide support services, but not necessarily get these practices in the ground. One of the concerns that I have is that if we go out and we tell folks to go ahead and put these practices in the ground and they don't have the necessary support services, and the regional board doesn't necessarily have an understanding of not only the cost but the time it takes to design these practices right to do their job, I want you guys to have realistic expectations on the farmers in terms of compliance. Three implementation options. Number one, do it yourself. Go out, cover the night, dig a hole. You're not going to get regulatory compliance per se, and there's going to be questions about the integrity of the project. Another option is looking at the private sector. Within Santa Cruz and Monterey County specifically, there's only about a handful of engineering firms that can provide the types of engineering support for the projects that we're talking about. The other option is RCDs and NRCS, and I've just demonstrated to you that we aren't going to have the ability to serve 2,500 farming operations within the region within any reasonable time frame. Costs. I wanted to just give you guys a little understanding about the costs of some of these engineered practices. Last year in the Elkhorn Slough watershed, we installed a project that was a $130,000 project. That was on a farm that was less than 200 acres. And when you're talking about who's going to actually pay the cost, it's either going to be the owner of the land or the operator. And in either case, the owner either has to increase the rent to make that a viable option to pay for it, or the tenant farmer has to pay for the cost, of which, because of grower-shipper relationships, they can't necessarily pass on those costs that they've incurred in the sale of their product. So it's not like other industries where you can just incrementally increase the cost of the goods that you're selling to be able to recover the cost for the practices implemented. Another example, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, if I can just finish this statement, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which is a cost-share program through the Farm Bill, through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, last year in Monterey County we had applications that were funded ranging from $10,000 to, I believe it was up to, well, it was $10,000 of NRCS money to $150,000 of NRCS money. It's at a 50% cost share rate. So per farm, you're talking about some projects that were $20,000 up to $300,000 projects. And that's a very significant expense when you start to look at the monitoring costs that maybe a couple grand a year, and I'm not saying that that's not important in terms of factoring in whether or not a farm operation can continue in business. But when you're talking about actually seeing changes in water quality, retaining water on site and not having off-site impacts, we're talking about some pretty serious costs here and some pretty serious implications to the viability of agriculture in the Central Coast. Thank you.
Mr. Young, you have a question?
A question for you, Ms. Hansen. What is your response to the situation where a farm is impacting water quality? It's demonstrated.
Everything, and
it's going to be expensive.
Everything we do is on a voluntary basis. Because we're in that unique position, we would assess the costs of a Cadillac version of a project down to a Yugo version of a project. And depending on what the cooperator can pay, we will make the best project to address the problem as we can for the cost of the project.
Okay, but you know, we have to address the water quality.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I agree that there are definitely some improvements that can be made with irrigation systems, but that's not the only thing. There are off-site impacts that come and impact agricultural land where a drainage from a county road, per se, could come in and rip a hole through ag land, and there's going to be off-site impacts. The land use may be agricultural land, but the cause of the problem may not be agricultural land. Everything is on a very site-specific basis, and it's really hard to make generalizations about cost, about degree of impact, about toxicity, about, you know, sediment load transporting downstream, what were the natural conditions like prior to the converted land use to agricultural to development. So it's really difficult, and it's site-specific, which is why we have a technical staff that we do to go out and assess the situation, come up with viable options, look at the costs, and implement the best option. I hope that answered your question. It's a tough one. It's something we struggle with on every project.
Thank you. Adrienne Morales.
Good afternoon, members of the board and ladies and gentlemen. This is a good opportunity for us to see water quality issues for different points of view. The Upper Salinas Las Tablas RCD are working in a water quality monitoring program for at least 3 years. We are monitoring the headwaters and surface waters of the Salinas River watershed in both urban and agricultural areas. This study has been funded in part by the State Water Quality Control Board, Regional Water Quality Control Board, and other foundations. Our data showed that the principal problems with nutrients, principally phosphates and sediments, are in urban areas. The values are highest than the agricultural areas, and affecting the water quality of a stream and the Salina River, and of course, the wildlife. Some of the ranchers and landowners into the agriculture business are receiving these polluted waters in their properties. In this county, there are a lot of agricultural activities that are taking care about the water quality in our streams and rivers. There are a lot of agencies, as Emily mentioned. We have here RCDs, we have NRCS, we have Farm Bureau, we have UC Cooperative Extension, and more agencies working together with agriculture ranchers and farmers to enhance the water quality in our county. Please, before to submit in writing the agriculture waiver and the fees, get all the information from the groups and agencies and the agriculture community that are doing water quality and check if the data achieve the State Water Quality Control Board standards. And after that, please set the statements into the agriculture waiver. Another request, please, before to submit this agriculture waiver, get more feedback from all these people that we are here and invest more in incentives to the people that are doing what good practices to improve and enhance the water quality in our region and in the Central Coast region. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tim Hollingsworth, then Don Warden.
Hi, I'm Timothy Hollingsworth. I've got a company called Green Gold Naturals. I'm kind of a believer in proactive approaches to the environment. What I primarily do is teach growers, chemical growers, how to grow with a natural program that not only doesn't use environmentally polluting ingredients, but actually turns the soil into an environmentally purification system by bioremediating the soil and also biologically activating the soil so that it actually works as a purification and carbon sequestration system. I really, of course, myself see the importance of water quality, and I know that it has to be monitored. What the solution is to the farmers having to put up the money for this is, I see that as a problem too. Somehow it needs to be monitored. I know the state's having a budget crisis and the county and everybody. One thing I've noticed in working, I work with a lot of chemical growers since I'm teaching them how to grow naturally. And one of the problems that I see is that a lot of growers just use more nitrate fertilizers, more chlorinated hydrocarbons, petrochemicals, whatever, normally than they need to use. Some growers I've seen are very what I would call finesse growers. They're able to make the plants and the soil grow using minimal numbers of these products. And just by virtue of that, they aren't environmentally polluters. A lot of growers I notice they pollute just because they don't know any better. What is the solution to this? There are agents called pesticide control agents that make themselves available to the growers to teach them what to use and how much to use. A lot of times these PCAs work for companies that make profits off of what they recommend. So and I've seen PCAs make recommendations way beyond what I thought was necessary. And because, well, for one, they want to solve the problem, and two, it doesn't hurt to make a little extra money off the deal. I understand the Department of Agriculture has PCAs on staff. I don't know if the county, it's probably not in the budget, if they could take a proactive approach to making PCAs available to growers so that they could have somebody to consult that could say, well, look, you don't need to use that this time. Maybe something a little lighter or less of that. I think most growers would be happy to have something like that because it's going to be less cost for them and spending for the products, and actually in the long run their crops would do better. I am in support of water control. That's about the best I can give at this point.
Thank you. Don Warden, then Don Dunlap.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Warden. I'm a farmer in the Los Osos Valley, involved in the Morro Bay estuary, and in two different watersheds in this particular area. I also could say ditto to all of the agricultural comments that have been made before you this evening, I think, or this afternoon. I farm on, as Chris Darway does, on some smaller parcels, where the owners faced with the charges, fees that you have, would not be able to either pay them or seriously impact their income. And that would get either transferred to me or impact them. Listening to the RCD presentation just a moment ago made me think of my own situation. I participated in both the ranch and the farm water quality short courses, so I've been in both of those. We've been trying to implement some of those things, ideas that we haven't done in the past, and certainly I can say that we've done many of them in the past. However, I'd like to give you one little example. I thought that it would be a good idea to catch some stormwater runoff at the bottom of two fields. The fields are small, 15, 20, 25 acres, and so I wanted to put in a sediment basin. The RCD wasn't capable of doing the engineering work, and they opted to go out to a private company. It came back with an estimate of over between $50,000 and $65,000, and even with some share that I might get from RCD or others, you know, it just wasn't feasible. And so I think that that presents a real difficulty in trying to improve water quality. And that brings me to my main point. I think that it is very important to, first of all, have a region-wide monitoring basis, like your staff is proposing. Secondly, I think that it is important that you go out and try to find grants to cover those costs and not put them on the agriculturalists and the landowners, because I think that every dollar that they have available, and if they've been through the short courses, those dollars ought to go toward improving water quality, not monitoring water quality. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Is Don Dunlap returned? Okay. And the last card I have is Bill Strubel.
One of the issues, I'm Bill Strubel, I'm an avocado farmer in the Nipomo area. One of the issues I didn't hear today was the one about a perception about the regional board having free access to our agricultural properties in the future, if you look at the proposal, for the purposes of performing inspections, conducting monitoring, if that goes forward. Now, due to the potential spread of pests, disease, and noxious weeds and infestations from vehicles, from our feet, shoes on, you know, the inspectors, we have to maintain phytosanitary conditions. For example, the spread of Phytophthora root rot by unwitting carriers has wiped out, well, thousands of acres of avocado groves in California. The spores are attached to the bottoms of hooves of horses or on the feet of people hiking through land. So therefore, permission for access must first be granted by the property owner, and the inspectors must be escorted if inspection is required, and it is per the permission of the property owner. A number of years ago, probably 15 years ago, I think it was, there were some puncture vine brought in on tires of a PG&E, a vehicle, which I no longer allow off the pavement of my property, of the orchard. And I've been working on that project until about last year, and I think I finally got it wiped out. So it's so easy to transfer on the radiators of vehicles, on the shoes of people, these diseases that can really cause a lot of problems.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to us who may or may not have a card? Mr. Briggs?
Yeah, Mr. Bruce Gordon turned in a card and said he did not wish to testify. Is Mr. Gordon still here? He did write some comments, so I think the easiest thing to do is just to read them.
Read them into the record, yes. Please do.
The board needs to seriously examine the premise of discharge for irrigators using drip irrigation micro sprinkler systems. Such systems under normal operation produce zero surface discharge, and users of such systems should be exempt from the provisions of this proposal. The idea that storm runoff from irrigated ag operations is universally a problem is also flawed. Specifically, drip micro sprinkler systems allow chemical applications to be controlled to the point that storm runoff is not a problem. Regarding monitoring, boards should concentrate monitoring where problems exist, not as a blanket requirement. There's more on this little card.
You have 3 minutes for your card.
He also used micro printing here to get this on here. Part of board outreach should inform consumers that compliance will increase the cost of food and fiber. And again, that was Mr. Bruce Gibson of Cayucas.
Good, thank you. Add to the stack. Okay, so with no one else wanting to testify, let's see if there's any board comments. Or you want to talk? Please do. Come on.
Board, thank you. I appreciate it. I wasn't going to speak. There are just a couple of things that weren't mentioned I think that are important.
Thank you.
I raise citrus and avocados in Nipomo, about 350 acres, and have a commercial avocado and citrus nursery. And I think the sanitary conditions is one thing that Bill Strubel mentioned that we are really high on, and everybody has to disinfect their feet and everything when they come in. We have most of our orchard fenced, and of course you get people and deer, and of course deer we could shoot. Inspectors, you probably can't do much about.
You might want to, huh? But you don't.
The point is, in Nipomo now, we talked about not much residential area up here. Yet in Nipomo, everybody wants to live in Nipomo, and they're all in the foothills behind us now. They start out with 40-acre lots, and then 20-acre lots, and now they're down to 5-acre lots. So we're getting quite a proliferation up there of homes up there, and all that water drains down and comes down through our drainage area. And I don't know, I mean, we can control agriculture, but we do. We can't afford that water run off our ranches. We can't afford it. But you get people living up behind there, and they're using chemicals that we can't use in an orchard, and ones we do that are regulated, they can go buy all around if they want without a permit and whatnot. So we have that coming off those houses. We've got a freeway there. Water running off the freeway and county roads running through our property. So there's other things involved besides pollutants coming off our orchards that we need to kind of consider along with our orchards pollution. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Anyone else? Sir, would you like to give us your name or don't have to? But would you like to give us your name or?
Sorry?
You don't have to, but.
No, I'm not embarrassed at all. Mike Cavalletto, Cavalletto.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Any board comments or questions? Mr. Young?
Just one thing that, as to the sanitary issue, which I think is pretty easy for us to deal with, I was looking at the resolution, and paragraph number 6, where you have language with respect to allowing access, perhaps you guys could develop some more language that would have access controlled so that the threat of cross-contamination to a farm is kept to the absolute minimum. And, you know, you might come back with some language in that we could look at later.
Any other comments or questions? I have a few things myself. We certainly heard a lot here today about variability, about having a program, because indeed, you know, there's lots of ranges of we're talking about here. There's, you know, traditional row cropping where there's lots of irrigation and tailwater, and then there's organic farming, and there's drip irrigation, or there's micro sprinklers or orchards. We heard a lot about orchards today, and clearly they have a lot of differences. So I think our, you know, our program needs to look at that variability and respond somehow. Of course, that's a slippery slope because we don't want to have to go out to every single thing and, you know, guess a number for every little thing, because indeed every farm is probably different than every other farm. Even two avocado farms are different. They have different slopes, different soils, different practices, different setting, and you clearly can't take it to the level of having each farm have a different monitoring cost. And by the way, that's what we're talking about here. In terms of fees, we don't do that. It would be the state board that does that. So we have no control over whether there ever is or is not and what the terms for those will be. But in terms of any kind of monitoring program, I think we need to have some kind of variability set into that. And I think probably the best way is rather than having us set those fees, of having the industry set them themselves. Because indeed, for every time you say, okay, this kind of a situation, the cost should go down, it means to keep things paid for, somebody else's costs have to go up. So if you decide to have organic farming pay less because they don't need as much monitoring, then someone else is going to have to pay more so that this watershed is still monitored. And I think, you know, having the industry deal with that is the right thing to do. They can make the trade-offs as to who pays more and who pays less. So I'm hoping that the practices platform committee you've put together can look at this and resolve this for us. I as well like the idea that monitoring should be variable based on the hotspot stuff, that in some areas that are basically fairly clean, we don't have to do a, you know, all-out attack of monitoring. And we need to do occasional monitoring just to make sure things are staying okay, but we should concentrate on monitoring and therefore probably the costs on those areas that have problems so that we can, you know, find those particular places that have the cause and fix them. And I agree that to the extent that there are existing monitoring data, we should incorporate that into our program so that we're not duplicating something that's already effective. Okay, those are the comments I had. All right. Does staff wish to have any reactions to anything they've heard, either public comment or board comment? No?
I do.
Okay.
Anything else from the board, though?
Well, I just want to thank everybody for being here, and some of you have been to all three of these workshops, and I do want to thank you for your time. Everything you said is very important to us, for us to make the final decision. And with your help, hopefully we can come to some kind of a program that will address all the issues and not have a tremendous impact upon you and your farms. We're here to help, and we're not here trying to hinder your operations. We didn't set the law. We're just trying to institute it. And we need your help, and we appreciate all of you for being here. Thank you.
Well, I think we need to recognize that we probably are not going to make everyone completely happy, but we need to do what's required, and we need to be
Roger's
fair.
Roger's happy. I think that is important.
Right, Roger's happy. But you know, I think all of us are trying to do the right thing, the fair thing, so yes, please. Thanks for coming.
I did have something to add.
Please go ahead.
actually, as a follow-on to Mr. Jeffrey's comment about the board being here trying to help. I know that probably sounds like we're government, we're here to give you a hand, but actually, our chair made a little joke about an hour ago about that's why we get the big bucks. And now we are staff. We do get paid. But the members of the board here, I don't know that it's commonly understood that they're basically volunteers. I mean, they get $100 per meeting, which in terms of the time that they put in, it's probably $2 to $5 an hour. And then on top of that,
on a good day, the wind is right.
These gentlemen all have jobs that they must have in order to support themselves. So this actually takes away from their livelihood. So what they're doing is really a community service volunteer job. And again, I don't know if that's commonly understood. And speaking of low-paying jobs, I noticed there was a really high turnout from the avocado growers. I'm not sure exactly why that is. I didn't know we had so many avocados grown in this area. But it does remind me that, believe it or not, over 40 years ago, 40 to 45 years ago, I had a weekend job as an avocado irrigator. And even back then, I was told that no water shall run off from the trees. I wasn't taught about the problem with spores and seeds. Maybe that predated that being a concern. But even back when water was probably relatively cheap, you know, there was still a concern about not letting any water run off and conserving water, believe it or not. Back to some specific comments that were made. There was a comment about the resolution not being available on the website, and we recognize that was a problem. And I'm not sure if it's on there now, but it will be, shall we say, shortly. And it's something that obviously has been evolving. So we'll try to make changes consistent with various comments that we've received today. For example, the item 6 that you pointed out, Mr. Young, as well as other refinements. We have talked about a low-tier type of a lowest-tier kind of a low-risk situation where maybe there would be next to zero or even zero costs. In fact, we tentatively call that tier zero to be sort of descriptive, and that's something that Allison wanted to bring up with the ag panel as a concept, another one of those loose ends that we wanted to follow through with. Also, regarding costs, I think it was Laura Plaskett asked where the cost came from as far as the, I think she was talking about the estimate, I don't know if she's still here, the estimates that we had for the monitoring costs. And Karen, you said that that's available and people can play with it, I think you said. Is it, that's not on our website though, is it? So maybe that's something we should make available too as a breakdown, because there seemed to be a great deal of interest and concern about the difference between the cooperative costs and how we arrived at those figures. And of course, we're trying to emphasize those are just estimates, but they were based on an itemized breakdown, you know, versus the individual costs. And we've seen the $15,000 figure. We've seen where that comes from, but I think where we need to provide some more information is where we're getting the estimated costs for the cooperative approach. So that's something that we can provide. And then, Allison, I was thinking maybe you could address the concern. I think it was Ray Beard who spoke about the October date versus the educational requirement and the lack of courses or the scarcity of courses.
Well, when the original setting up of the tiers was partly to acknowledge that there's been a considerable effort by several within the region to proactively, without being required to, get the education and develop a plan. So in trying to acknowledge that, people that already had that completed would qualify for the highest tier or the least reporting requirements. There's still, and the intent is that everyone else will have 3 years to meet all the requirements. So no, it's not a requirement that everyone have that done by the beginning of, by the enrollment date. And we understand that's not going to happen.
And then I guess just to, did you have anything else to wrap up, Just to reiterate then, we were shooting for March. As of yesterday, Karen said, we're kind of on the ropes on that, but it looks to me like...
I saw a May date there.
From the presentation, they're off the ropes, and they're landing on May. So we will be circulating that. We'll have a comment period on the final documents, including the negative declaration, proposed negative declaration. And we should have enough time for adequate public comment period, and then bring that back to the board in May, it appears. And that's it, Mr. Chair. Okay. I'd like to thank everybody for showing up, too. I know it takes a lot of time out of your lives to do this, but we appreciate your participation.
Your comments have encouraged Mr. Young to make some further comments, so why don't you let us know what you have.
A couple of things that I wanted to add, and this is from going over my notes from the previous workshop and then reading all of the letters that were submitted. I think we need to, if you haven't already, tried to go after all the grant funds that might be available for the education classes.
Or for all the programming.
For all of the programming that we need. I mean, that should be done, you know, as soon as you're able to do that. I do like the idea of maybe focusing on two or three regions within the Central Coast where we could set up some monitoring programs that would be the easiest to implement, because we would have watershed groups that could help facilitate organizing that type of monitoring effort, and then maybe phase in the other areas as long as the other areas are of, you know, very have low impact to them already. I'd like to see us doing more to do outreach to the Spanish-speaking community. And do we need a Spanish hotline? Do we need more? Do we need Spanish documents on the website? I mean, I don't know what we need, but you know, you guys will have to address that. But I would like to see as much effort as we can apply towards that to get that part of our regulated community in, into the fold. Let's see. And that really is it. You know, my own comments in general to everybody is that I have read every piece of paper that has been given to me. I go over my notes. I've got my binder from Salinas. I've got the notes from Santa Barbara. And so you can rest be assured that I think most of us do this. We go over everything. And, you know, in the end, as our chair said, some may not like the outcome, but you can be rest assured at least we have considered everything and are going to do best we can to make this work as free of problems as possible. So I think that's about all we can really, you know, hold out to you, is that we're really trying to do this right and to take into consideration everything possible.
Could I just add really quickly about the Spanish-speaking effort? One thing that is happening this month is they're starting a Spanish farm water quality short course, and Amanda Byrne is going to be the Region Board staff representative. She's been working hard to get the program put together, the presentation, so that it could be translated into Spanish. And so that's going to happen. I'm doing a presentation at the Ag Expo up in Watsonville this month as well, and that'll all be translated into Spanish.
Good. Thank you. If there is nothing further to the further of the further, I call this meeting adjourned, and we will reconvene tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
How you doing?
Good, sir.
Oh, sorry, can I get a copy of that PowerPoint?
I would need
Okay. You got your email address on it?
Yes, it is on there somewhere.
I don't have my glasses on me. So.
It's on there, yes.
All righty, we'll do.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
All righty, thanks.
Here to our admin revenue rent sweater. Is it appropriate to speak as we're going up? Something that came to mind is
I mean, look, so what we're looking at is very